Okay, I'd like to convene the Finance Committee. We're too short right now of a quorum, so what we will do is begin the presentations of the bills, and then if you can remain, if we don't have a quorum when we're done with your bill, for us to take action once we have a quorum. So, Representative Kanth, if you could give us an overview of the bill, and then we'll just hold it until we have a quorum.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair.
And we will take questions as well at this point.
I'm sorry?
We will take questions as well at this point.
Sounds good. House File 3589 is a bill that just makes some changes to the reporting thresholds for contracts. Specifically, first of all, make sure that ranking minority members get some of the information in the contract reports from the commissioner. And then the secondary and probably the most substantive portion of the bill is that it lowers the threshold for the reporting from $50,000 to $25,000 and then strikes the one-page status of it. Through conversations with the Legislative Reference Library, the statement of saying that, you know, to limit that is actually going to do some undue service if somebody wants to report more and give some more information about a contract or any questions or concerns with a contract or some positives that came out of it, they should be able to do that. Also then making the report publicly available online. At first, admin had some questions about the possibility of doing this and whether or not it could actually happen. So we kind of change the language a little bit and then move the effective date out a year, so then that way it would give them some time as SWIFT is coming forward and some other programs about making this available online. Again, providing some sunshine to make sure that these contracts are available to the public and we can make sure that we're looking at the vendors and how it is that we are reporting these contracts out. And that is the bill, Mr. Chair and members.
And are there questions then of Representative Kanth? Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kanth, I'm assuming that this also applies to the Minsky system. Am I mistaken? Or?
Representative Kanth.
I am getting a shake of the head of no, this does not apply to the Minsky system.
Okay.
Representative Rucavina.
Well, that's good. That's the beginning anyway. But I'm just wondering, is by the reduction in the contract amount to $25,000, how many more contracts then do we capture by reducing that amount, and how much more work is there for the agencies to put to do the requirements in this bill and put it online and everything else, and is there a fiscal note at all with this?
I'll bring a representative from admin down, but my understanding is that the reports have to be done regardless, but whether or not they are actually reported to the reference library is the threshold, but I will let admin share a little bit more about that.
Okay, and if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Kaufman. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Administration. Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavina, in answer to your question, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me that relate to the additional numbers that we're collecting as far as reports, but I believe currently last fiscal year would be around 700 vendor performance reports that we received, and I believe we would be receiving about an additional 300.
And there won't, Mr. Chair, is it Mr. Kaufman?
Yes.
There won't be any additional cost by doing that to the agencies?
Well, for the agencies, they're submitting the reports. We had a conversation with the group that we meet with representatives from the various agencies dealing with professional technical contracts. And in that meeting, a lot of the agencies indicated that they're already filling out vendor performance reports at a lower dollar amount for contracts, they just may not be submitting them through us. And so there was not any significant pushback or belief by this group of individuals that there would be really any additional cost that could not be borne by the agencies.
Representative Rucavina.
Representative Kanth, congratulations. Admin obviously likes their bill, because if they didn't, there would be a fiscal note on this for millions of dollars.
So thank you, Representative Rucavina.
Any additional questions? Representative Broad.
Thank you. And Representative Rucavina, I think that might be the first thing you've said that I agree with.
Oh, come on.
Oh, there might have been one other, I think, maybe, but at least today, anyway. We'll start from there. But actually, Representative Kathan, and to the, I'm sorry, I didn't catch Mr. Kaufman, is it?
Yes.
I'm curious about, you know, I think it was in 2000 and, gosh, I want to say five. I'll just choose a number. Representative Paulson had some legislation called Google Government, and the intent of that legislation was to ensure that all contracts, all state contracts, were actually eligible or available to the public through an online mechanism. And then, in fact, the governor expanded that through an executive order, I think, or some type of executive action that provided for some additional state expenditures to be available online on the MMB website. Now, I'm not a fan of the website and how user-friendly it is, but I'm curious, why didn't those laws actually require or cover this legislation? Because I obviously am a fan of getting as much information out there for the public in a way that is sensical and that they can actually use. But why isn't this already in law?
Which of you, Mr. Kaufman, do you want to respond or Representative Kath?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I was not here in 2005, so I cannot tell you why. I'm bringing this forward now to try and create some of that sunshine, and I mean, we can find out as it moves to the floor why this wouldn't have been included in those previous moves, but unless Mr. Kaufman knows.
Mr. Kaufman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that predates me as well, so I'm unable to give the historical background on it. I am familiar with the TAP program right now, and that is going to be replaced in the new SWIFT project by, I believe, the Citizens Portal. That's going to have additional information that hopefully is more to your liking. I don't know why this was not included. I can imagine one of the reasons is that this is information that is gathered after the contracts are closed out. It is not gathered in the current accounting and financial tool system, the MAP system that's there. This was collected as part of a paper process that the Department of Admin would collect, review, and then forward onto the Legislative Reference Library. So making this available online is something newer that we have done in the last year. With some limitations, we will have to do some additional work. Reason that there's no fiscal note on this now is that Representative Kath was nice enough to provide language here for us that allows us to do it within our current structure. But my comments as far as why this was not included are limited to that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just to follow up,
if
somebody from the department could come and follow up with me before the floor on this, I think it would be very helpful because, you know, the whole fiscal note issue is kind of interesting because Representative Rukavina, when Representative Paulson brought forward that legislation related to the Google government, I believe it was about a $5 million fiscal note that was put on that. And by the way, it got done for about $5,000 in the end. And so it's kind of an interesting disparity between the fiscal note and the actual cost of the project. But it just seems to me, Representative Kath, I like the approach. I like what you're trying to do. I'd rather the number was zero because I think every dollar that the state government spends should be available to the citizens to take a look at. And so, you know, I'd like to get more information. You know, we have MAP, we have TAP, we have SWIFT. Those are all acronyms that were just thrown out. All I want is for dollars to be, we have CON now.
No.
So MAP, TAP, and SWIFT are going to be on the CON accountability website. But we have all these acronyms, and all I really want is for citizens to be able to track the dollars that are spent by the politicians of the state. And so I look forward to chatting with you a little bit further on this issue.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Kaufman.
Representative, I want to note that the bill that Representative Kath is bringing forward here just relates to the vendor performance reviews that are done now at the will now be done at the $25,000 threshold. It does not mean, this does not put any limitations on what's reported in the TAP system or reported under vendor spending. It just relates to the evaluations that are done by the agencies as far as vendor performance. So I just want to clarify.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kaufman, I appreciate that. I think that's a good clarification. I do think, however, that MNSCU and the other systems ought to be included as well. Again, it's sunshine for everybody, sunshine for one, sunshine for all. But I appreciate talking about this further with you.
And Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative, I apologize. I cannot see your nameplate.
Oh, that's okay. Broad.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, we now have a quorum. We've got a couple more people with questions, but to officially convene the meeting. I think Representative Benson, as has become the tradition in the last few meetings, has thoroughly studied the minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have, and I move the April 13th minutes.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. So then that we get the bill before us officially. Representative Kahn.
I move the State Government Finance Division report for House File 3589, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion to adopt the division report is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Representative Kahn.
Then I move House File 3589, the first committee engrossment to be recommended, passed, and placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us, and then the next person with a question was Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Mr. Kaufman, can you tell me, I'm just curious, how are these reports presented presently to the chairs of the Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee? Are they presented, are they sent electronically? Are we cluttering mailboxes? How are we doing it presently?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe currently we're providing paper copies.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kaff, I can't recall exactly what the report or what the change that was made within the last couple of years was, but there's, I think, a requirement that all these be available electronically. I know we're putting them online. Let's chat between now and the floor as to whether sending paper copies makes sense. I get, as the ranking member on Public Safety Finance, I get a lot of paper copies, and I'd rather not have those things end up in the recycling bin. I'd rather have them stored in a computer file, which is a lot easier for me to access. And so let's talk about whether this makes sense to have 700 pieces of paper or whatever the number of reports are moving to Chairman Carlson and Chairman Solberg and our friends over in the Senate, you know, on each and every one of these. I'm not sure that makes sense. Let's, if we can streamline it and do it electronically, let's do that.
Representative Solberg, on paper copies?
Well,
I'm thinking of your district.
I'm thinking of my district, yeah. You're trying to make my unemployment rate go up higher again, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg.
The paper mills are up.
Well, Representative Solberg, you know, in light of the situation in your district, and because I know you're a passionate advocate for the timber industry and the employees in your district, I would strongly encourage you to print a copy when it's sent to you electronically, and you can do your part to help out the timber industry, Representative Solberg.
Well, both quick on your feet this morning, then. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles. One of the other nice things, though, about when you store it electronically, it's helping all the mining industry with, like, polymeth and so forth, right?
I think we're wandering a bit. That's the fault of the chair here right now. Representative Representative Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm glad that Representative Ruckovina and Broad brought up the fiscal note issue, and this is a good committee to do it in because we've got a lot of fiscal chairs, past, present, future, in this committee. This is something that the Legislative Audit Commission was close to acting on this year. It's a passion of mine to look into, have the Legislative Audit Commission look into the process. I think we all know it's subject to manipulation, and this isn't a Pawlenty administration thing. This goes back, you know, decades. If someone doesn't like something, they're going to load it up with a big fiscal note. If they love it, they're going to say it's free and easy and wonderful. And I think one of the answers to that, I mean, the reason that it wasn't done in the Legislative Audit Commission is there are a lot of complications there and how you look at a problem like that. But I think part of the solution to that is to have fiscal chairs scrutinize fiscal notes more. I know different chairs have different styles, but I think it's not a good thing when chairs too often, in my opinion, in my observation, accept fiscal notes as if they're sort of tablets handed down from God and they can't be, you know, deviated from in any respect. We all know what can happen and what does happen. And I would just encourage, strongly encourage, based on my own experience with my bills and other bills, I would encourage chairs to scrutinize fiscal notes. I don't care who the governor is or where it comes from. These are not words from God. These are estimates. They're as much art as they are science. They're predictions by fallible human beings that can make mistakes, or, and I think too often, you know, it's really tempting because it's easier to just, you know, accept them without any scrutiny. So that's my 2 cents worth on an issue that I feel strongly about, because, you know, we want to get it right, obviously, and we don't want to engage in the same manipulation the other way, but I think it's a process that's, in my relatively short time here, subject to manipulation. It's important that we talk about it.
I, the only comment, Representative Solberg and I had a meeting with Commissioner of Finance the other day, as, and in that case also the Department of Human Services, because in that case there's been a real timing problem as we try to get the bills put together. But a part of that conversation was also the accuracy of the fiscal notes that we sometimes get. And you're absolutely correct, we should look at them carefully. I received one myself on a bill that I had from the Department of Education, not, was it last year or the year before, and you wouldn't believe all that they built into it, and highly questioned that fiscal note. And there are times when we've requested that they review a fiscal note and make changes if we thought it was too far out of line, but that's one chair. I suspect, as you're saying, it may vary from one chair to another as to how they react to those, although Representative Solberg and I have, and I think Representative Kahn as well, because she chairs that special subcommittee on fiscal notes as well. So you're absolutely correct. It's a major concern of many of us. Any further discussion on the CATH bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to just note, since we brought up the fiscal note, that there originally was a fiscal note on the original unamended language brought forth by Representative Kath. The reason the fiscal note has gone away is by the simple process of working with Representative Kath, and we certainly appreciate that, and the ability to change really just a few words, changed our obligation from having a fiscal note related to the creation of a database to being able to use current online tools that we have available to us at minimal cost. And the simple process of changing a few words in the language of the bill allowed us to remove that fiscal note and absorb the nominal cost that's going to be there.
Okay. Any further questions or comments then on the bill? Okay. Representative Kahn then renews her motion that House File 3589, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank
and
you,
we'll
Chairman.
Go down then to House File 3046 by Representative Rood.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huntley, you want to make a couple of motions?
Mr. Chair, I move the Healthcare and Human Services Finance Division report for House File 3046, the first committee engrossment.
The motion to adopt the division report is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Huntley?
I move House File 3046, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, that motion is before us. And Representative Huntley, I understand you have an amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would like.
There are two amendments, but we only want one, and that I would move the A5 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us, and did everybody get both amendments? Yeah, both amendments are in the packet, so be sure you're looking at the right one then. It's the A5 amendment, and the other one will not be offered. Any discussion on the A5 amendment? Okay, seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Rood, then, if you would like to walk us through the bill and tell us if there's any fiscal impact and what
have you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3046 is a bill to license birth centers. A birth center is a facility licensed for the primary purpose of performing low-risk deliveries that is not a hospital. Research confirms that for the appropriate patient, birth centers offer a safe and cost-effective way to provide care. I want to note that this is a timely bill, as the federal health care bill that was just signed into law guarantees facility payments to birth centers. Currently in Minnesota, we have two birth centers in operation, two that are
working to come online. They are going through an accreditation process, but there is currently no state law that regulates birth centers. This bill seeks to license birth centers, thereby setting a standard of care. The bill states that to be licensed, birth centers would have to go through a rigorous process and become accredited through the Commission for the Accreditation of Birth Centers, or CABC, which is highly regarded. The amendment we have added today expands the participants in a group that will evaluate the quality of care and outcome of services provided in birth centers, which will be reported back to the legislature. We also added language that speaks to the reimbursement rate, and I want to note that for the record that though this is still an area of discussion, I do want to thank DHS for working with us. We are in kind of negotiations regarding what the facility rates would be for reimbursement, but all of the scenarios that we have discussed with DHS do indicate a cost savings for the state of Minnesota. And that essentially is the bill, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sol.
With the language that was put on it with the amendment, does that change the fiscal note at all?
No.
Representative
thank you, Mr. Chair. No, Representative Solberg. I believe the fiscal note, I'm looking for DHS, but I think the latest fiscal note that you have
Mr. Marks can maybe be helpful on that. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Rood, the fiscal note in the package, which is for Senate file 2702-3A, is actually the bill as it came into the committee.
Correct.
With the amendment on it, the general fund savings will be roughly half of what's in this fiscal note, but there will still be general fund savings.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Did you want to have the department add to that?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I can.
Dave Freeman.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think it's been a while, but since you've been before this committee, I know you're before Health and Human Services.
I've never been lucky enough to be before this committee. Mr. Chair, the amendment to the bill, I should step back and say, when the bill was drafted, we put the fiscal note together, we made some assumptions about what we would be paying the birthing centers. And one of the assumptions was that we would pay them 50% of what the average rate that a hospital gets for providing an uncomplicated birth. The Representative Rood, what this amendment does is it increases that to 70% of what a hospital gets, and that's why we got the amendment yesterday afternoon. We adjusted the fiscal note, so the savings is a bit smaller, but it's still there.
Thank you. Okay, any further discussion?
Well, and you will forward the revised fiscal note to us. It's very good. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, then Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 3046, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Okay, we'll now go down to, thank you, House
thank you.
File.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
2753, Representative Morrill. And Representative Champion, do you want to make the appropriate motions for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division report for House File 2753, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us to adopt the division report. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. And Representative Champion?
I move House File 2753, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and there is
an amendment.
An amendment, and Representative Champion, do you want to move that amendment?
Yes,
I think
Mr.
It's
Chair. I move
in the order that Representative Morrow would like.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us to adopt the A2 amendment. And is this technical? It's not. Maybe you might comment briefly about the amendment then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, what the A2 amendment does is delete language that accelerated $200 million in bond authority for MnDOT. This language appeared in the bonding bill that the governor signed into law, so that's why it's being omitted. So it's not technical, but it is deleting about $200 million of bonding authority that's already been authorized.
And it'll be a part of the way you present the bill then. Okay. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, what this bill does is authorize MnDOT, now with the A2 amendment, to do two things: to appropriate $30 million in trunk highway bonds for trunk highway construction, and $70 million for fiscal year 2011 for interchange work, 50% of that money going to the metropolitan area, 50% to greater Minnesota. This has been a tremendous economic development tool. We've heard of a number of projects. I attended a press conference that the governor and Commissioner Sorrell held touting these projects. Again, this is permissive language. My understanding is that MnDOT is neutral. MnDOT can't come out and support this, but it can handle the debt service. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any discussion? Well, seeing none then, Representative Champion renews his motion that House File 2753, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Yep, thank you. Okay, Representative Winkler is not here, so we'll temporarily pass over the House File 2754. That brings us down to one of the bills that was laid over yesterday, House File 3458. Representative Szymanski. And I'd like to turn the chair at this point over to Representative Benson.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division report for House File 3458, the first committee engrossment.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Szymanski.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. First, I would like to
let's see. You student need to move your yes. Bill.
All right. I move the House File 3458 for first committee engrossment be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I also have an amendment.
Okay. Would you like to move your amendment now?
Okay. The amendment is RA-10-309.
All right. Representative Szymanski moves amendment 309. Any discussion? Should be in the packet. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has no fiscal impact, also similar to the other bills we've heard this morning. But it basically recommends that the MnDOT consult with various groups that would be impacted by the design and placement of roundabouts on state highways and also may affect counties and communities as well. So what we're doing here is asking MnDOT to consult with the Minnesota Trucking Association and also those groups that normally use the highways with oversized loads, permitted loads. And yesterday, the amendment was brought forward by the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities so that MnDOT would also consult with them in the design of roundabouts in urban areas.
Thank you, Representative. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, does this affect then the cities as well?
Representative Szymanski.
MnDOT will put together the recommendations, the specifications and standards for design that would then be promulgated for the use by cities and counties.
Representative Solberg.
Wow. My city, Grand Rapids, has put in two or three roundabouts, and I think they're it's a very easy way of controlling some safety issues on streets. And I understand maybe not everyone likes them, but I think if they're designed in the correct fashion, it slows traffic down, and it also doesn't impede traffic as well. I mean, it's a, I think, a very good safety issue, but as long as the cities are supportive of this.
I have no comment to no opposition.
Sure. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Representative Schmansky, I apologize. I was downstairs in another committee. I don't know if the issue came up, but I was contacted just last week by a constituent. MnDOT has put two roundabouts on Highway 7 running through my district, one at Highway 7 and Carver County, County Road 10, and one at Highway 7 and Highway 25. And the constituent who contacted me is absolutely thrilled that they're there. They slow down traffic at those intersections that had a lot of high impact accidents prior to the roundabouts going in. We've had a couple issues with truckers, and so I'm pleased to see that that's a part of the bill. Her concern, though, was that she believes that there are still a lot of Minnesotans who don't understand, because roundabouts are new, how to properly navigate their way through them. And she, as somebody who is frequently going through those intersections, has run into all kinds of trouble. I know that MnDOT, on the state maps that they publish in the last year or so, has put roundabout information. Her request was that MnDOT take a look at or consider some additional signage or changing the signage as people approach roundabouts. The biggest concern is that people don't seem to understand that once somebody's in the roundabout, they have the right of way. And so I'm curious if your conversations with MnDOT have involved at all the signage issue, and whether you've heard that they're open to considering, maybe as part of this roundabout design issue, what the appropriate signage should be in or around roundabouts.
Representative Schmansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Coles, I appreciate that question, because that was one of the issues that I had as a primary focus with this bill, was the signage and the information available to drivers as they approach roundabouts. The issue, referring to the same roundabouts that you did, Representative Coles, was a cattle hauler trucking through the district middle of the night from South Dakota. Did not know or understand that there was a roundabout in his route, and proceeded at a high rate of speed into the roundabout and tipped his trailer over with a load of cattle. So I did have a considerable discussion with MnDOT about improving the signage on roundabouts, and I think they're working on that very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schmansky.
Representative Kahn.
Well, we lived in southwestern France for a couple of months while my husband was teaching there, and one of the shocking things is the total obedience to right-of-way in the roundabouts. And I would be riding my bicycle, and I would hit an entrance to a roundabout, and there would be some big car pulling up to it, and I couldn't believe they were going to give me the right-of-way. And so I would slow down, which would get them really mad, because they wanted me to go by really fast so they could then go. So I hope people also understand that bicycles have the right-of-way in roundabouts, too. Just a comment.
Any other discussion?
I'll withhold my comment.
Yes, they do. They're a vehicle. So.
Change that. Kip Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I totally agree with you. I was visiting our son, and they had a roundabout, and he expressed people who don't know how to use them. And that's typical when you have something new, and we'll all kind of catch on to it as you have more. But I would agree that the signage could be better, or they could do more educational kinds of things, or cities and counties, when they put them in place, that they could incorporate that. But I think the question I have for you, Representative Schmansky, has to do with the disabled persons. And have you gotten any indication of what the issues are for this particular constituency in regards to roundabouts?
Representative Schmansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Kishmeyer. I just had that conversation yesterday afternoon with the representatives of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. And it was primarily at crosswalks access, how people, with other vehicles, wheelchairs or scooters or how they might, you know, approach roundabouts or you know, manage to cross a roundabout. So,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Szymanski. And I'm glad to hear that because I think those are those kinds of things that we do need to consider. So glad that's a part of your bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Szymanski renews his motion that House File 3458, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Mr. Chairman, as amended.
Motion. As amendment.
All right. Excuse
me.
Thank you,
yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. Take the chairs. Representative Carlson. Representative Kahn.
Oh, okay. Yes, I move that the state government finance report for House File 2577, the first committee engrossment.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a constitutional amendment.
You want to move that bill,
oh,
maybe?
I should move the bill. That's correct. Yes, I'd like to move that House File 2577 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, this is a constitutional amendment allowing the legislature to call a special session. And it's an amendment that I view that would provide more balance between the branches of government. It would provide for additional transparency. It has the potential to eliminate gridlock and would allow the legislature to act promptly to disasters. Simply provides more flexibility for state government. House File 2577 then would, to give you a brief overview, put the state of Minnesota in the same place that 33 other states are and where they have the capability to call a special session, including our neighboring states of Iowa and Wisconsin. In the vast majority of these states, the legislature rarely calls a special session. However, the ability of the legislature to call a special session would provide a balance between the branches of government and, as I pointed out, reduce gridlock. In the last few years, there have been several ongoing debates that have warranted calling a special session. After the 2007 session, the critical need for a comprehensive transportation bill and the need to pass a tax bill to provide property tax relief would be examples. In addition, this change would allow the legislature to respond more quickly to catastrophic events. When the I-35 bridge collapsed and the floods hit southeastern Minnesota, there was ongoing confusion about whether or not the governor would call a special session to address these problems. At times such as these, any delay is costly. The state legislature was ready to act, and with this change, we could have done so. Finally, the bill allows for additional transparency and flexibility in the process by limiting the number of legislative days to 7. It allows enough time for the public to be able to participate and the flexibility to shape legislation based on that dialogue, while at the same time ensuring these issues are resolved in a timely manner. One of the questions that came up, and I want to make it clear, was by directing this particular amendment at the current administration, and the answer to that is no. We also had testifying in support of the bill, the League of Women Voters, and they were asked a question as to whether they were taking a political position or not, and as a result of recent events, and they pointed out that this has been and there's a letter that you have in there with theirs in your packets with their support. But going back to the 1950s, they had been supportive of the legislature being able to call itself into special session. In addition to that, members, I first introduced this bill in the early 1980s, or a version of it. So it's an issue that I've worked on in the past, and have chosen as a result of the events that took place recently to bring the bill forward. So that's the bill in terms of the background. There is a cost to the Secretary of State's office of $2,000, which is the amount that you'll see in the fiscal note, and the Secretary of State's office would be able to absorb that cost. So minimal fiscal impact, but in keeping with our policy, it does need to go to Ways and Means because it does have a $2,000 cost attached to it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Carlson, I'm trying to read through the fiscal note. So the assumption in the fiscal note related to what is going to be absorbed by the legislature is that only one special session day would be available or is accounted for in this fiscal note. Do you think that assumption is a likely assumption? I mean, if we get called into special session, is the result, do you think, just one day?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, they were basing that, as I read the note, on what it costs per day when you have a special session, whether that's the governor or if it were the will of this committee and the general public to pass the amendment. So theoretically, what you'd have to do if the legislature called a special session and used all 7 days, you'd have to multiply that $36,000 by seven. However, what's happened often is a practical matter. There's been prior agreement before a special session has been called, and most of the special sessions that I've been a part of, although there have been a few that have gotten long and drawn out, were one-day special sessions, although they were convened by the governor. So it's a little hard to predict whether they'd use all seven, so they're giving you a heads-up that it would be about $36,000 per day. But it would also be absorbed within the House budget. There would not be a need for a special appropriation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
And Representative Carlson, theoretically speaking then, that's the 7 days would be for one special session, but there's nothing in the legislation, or maybe you can point to me where in the legislation it does not allow. Is it only one special session available per year? Is it only 7 days per one special session, but you can recall the special session and start stacking dates on top of each other? How does that all work?
Well, events drive the need for special sessions. I think Representative Kahn and I were here in the early 80s, maybe some others, when the governor called six special sessions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
That was a Republican governor, so.
Representative Carlson.
So currently, if a governor calls special sessions, there isn't any limit on the number. But I would point out, and you have a handout, that the states that do have this mechanism available, and there are 33 of them, you'll see that the number of special sessions called by legislative bodies is very rare. I think if you were to begin to stack special sessions, the legislative leadership and the members would probably get a strong public reaction if it appeared that you were unnecessarily calling special sessions. But if you had two major events within a year, the 35W collapse was one event. The flooding in southeastern Minnesota was another event, so I suppose theoretically, had the governor not called a special session, you might have had, with those two major events in the same year, two special sessions.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson. It seems to me that in those scenarios, it was taken care of through, you know, I mean, I just really don't necessarily see the need for the legislature to have that broad authority. There's nothing in your language that doesn't allow for the stacking of special sessions. If I were a constituent, or I am a citizen, but if I'm looking at this on the ballot, I'd say, oh my gosh, do I really want a full-time legislature? And the ability to broaden and make more liberal the opportunity for legislators to be full-time is I think going to be of concern to many, so I'm not sure I don't want this on the ballot, to be able to tell you the truth. And I'm looking at these 33 states. Well, 38 states have lower taxes. Maybe we ought to lower taxes too. I mean, I don't think we ought to do things just because other states are taken a look at it. But Representative Carlson, I guess I'm concerned about the fiscal note. I don't think that a one day special session is a very good indicator of what reality is. If it's a one day special session that everybody agrees to, seems to me that the mechanism we have in place right now, where the governor can call the special session, ought to take care of that because it's agreed to. The other thing, Representative Carlson, I'd like to see in your amendment, if this is about making sure that we're moving forward and doing things in the right manner, bringing everybody to the table, I sure think it actually makes sense to have a minority representation on this ability to call a special session. If it's about getting things done quickly and having some of those prior approvals, let's have a minority member being able to help call that special session. How about the minority leader in the House or the Senate, whether it's a Republican legislature, we should have a Democratic minority involved. If it's a Democratic legislature, we should have a Republican minority involved. It seems to me that the ability to call special sessions should be few. And it should be something we don't do very often. So I think if it is an extenuating circumstance, if you're going to put this on the ballot, if this passes, there should be representation by the minority to make sure that there's buy-in on all sides.
Representative Carlson.
Your second point, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, the minority party does have an opportunity for input. If you'll notice that it has to also be approved by the Rules Committee in both bodies, and the Rules Committee is made up of both the majority and the minority. So they have an opportunity through that vehicle. The other part of your comments, by the way, if you'll keep in mind, in addition to providing more balance between the legislature and the administration, whoever that administration may be, or whoever the majority may be in the legislature, I've always found it interesting when legislators argue against their having a greater role, but be that as it may, that may be a little bit of one's philosophy. But if you'll recall, when I initially gave the reasons for the bill, a couple of points that I made, eliminating gridlock and also providing for more transparency. And that's something that I've always felt very strongly about. My interest in openness in government and transparency, quite frankly, goes back to my very first term 38 years ago. I was the chief author initially, although wasn't the final author, the one that passed, of Minnesota's open meeting law. So transparency from the get-go, so to speak, has been something I'm interested in. And what happens typically now, and I've carried some of this legislation, is that there are meetings held in private in the governor's office between key leaders, and then an announcement is made as to what the agreement is. Legislators have typically, as a broad-based group, have had little involvement, and the public has had virtually no involvement. So for me, transparency is vitally important. And so if the legislature calls a special session, the committees are activated, the public has an opportunity to come in and testify for or against whatever the proposals may happen to be at a given point in time, or to testify on the need for legislative action. So for me, transparency is a very important part of this whole process. And I'll just tell you a short story. Back in the early 80s, when Governor Cui was in office, Roger Moe was the majority leader, Tex Sieben was the Speaker of the House. I'm at home watching the news at 10 o'clock at night. They're both on camera. They're shaking hands. They've reached an agreement on a budget balancing bill totaling almost $1 billion. They go off camera, and I receive a phone call. Representative Carlson, do you still have, and it was Tex Sieben, a certain bill that I had, an immigration resource bill, nothing to do with the budget, in conference committee? And I said, yes. And he said, well, we have an amendment for you tomorrow morning. And this was the budget balancing bill totaling $1 billion. So when I talk about transparency, I think it's important. And by the way, that can be an interesting experience 12 hours later, presenting a billion-dollar bill on the House floor that you've had a chance to read the summary of and answer questions on. But at any rate, I'm just interested in the transparency and the balance of power issue here.
So I'll stop there and take any additional questions, Mr. Chairman. But remember, the fiscal impact is about $2,000.
Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, if we're interested in transparency, the fiscal impact is absolutely not just $2,000. The fiscal impact is up to about $250,000 per session called. And so, you know, I mean, I think we have to be real about the numbers. If you're saying, and I agree with you, that it's not good policy to bring forward something and drop it on somebody's desk and say, hey, this is the deal. We get that every year. It's not good policy. We get that every budget year. We're going to drop a $2 billion tax increase on the desk with nobody having the opportunity to see what's in it. You know, it's not good policy. I agree with you. But if your argument is, and I look at the fiscal note, and the fiscal note is only showing $36,000 of cost for one day special session. If the argument is that we don't want the pre-approved special session where we just come in and rubber stamp, then these numbers are just faulty. So, I mean, we think we have to be real about the actual cost to taxpayers, and the actual cost to taxpayers for each special session could be at the very least over $250,000. And there's no minimum, or I mean, there's no cap, there's no maximum on the number of special sessions that could be called. So if we have a difficult situation that we're dealing with and we don't pre-approve it, we don't pre-agree, we come in and we get through our 7 days and we haven't solved the problem, we're going to end up with another 7 days, and that's another $250,000. So now we're in a $500,000 cost. So I think we have to be real and transparent about the potential cost to taxpayers, in addition to the theory that, oh, we'll just come in and get it done within one day. Well, it seems to me if that's the goal, we have a mechanism in place right now to get that done. And if that's the goal, to come in and get some things done quickly to solve a real problem, I don't know why we would exclude minority members from making that decision. If you look at the Rules Committee, you say that there's opportunity in the Rules Committee. Well, if you're prepared to make sure that there's equal representation on the Rules Committee for minority and majority members, I might agree with you that that would be a good place. But there's not. It's very heavily skewed on the majority side, and it was when we were in charge. I'm not saying that's just the way the Rules Committee runs. That is not real representation. If we want to make sure that this is the best opportunity to get things done quickly, we should have, in addition to the signatures required by the majority, by the Speaker and the Majority Leader of the House, why wouldn't you just say, and the Minority Leader of the Senate and the Minority Leader of the House? It just seems to me that if the goal is actually problem solving, and these are going to be used in a very if it's going to be used very, very rarely, why wouldn't you do that?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've reached the point where we may be going in circles here. You've made your points, Representative Broad. I've made mine. You've restated basically the same question now. My goals, I think, are a little different than what you're articulating. I indicated that I was interested in more transparency, more balance of power between the branches. The minority party, yes, does have, in my view, input through the Rules Committee. If you look at the handout I gave you between 1990 and 2000, looking at representative sampling of the states that have the power, Arizona's a kind of interesting 32 special sessions, even outdoing us in the early 80s, I guess. But zero were called by the legislature. Delaware, six by the governor, three by the legislature. Florida, 10 by the governor, four by the legislature. Hawaii, one and one. And then you get into Illinois, Nebraska, North Carolina, zero. This is a 10-year period. Without belaboring it, several of those states were zero called by the legislature. But I'll just stop there.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson. You know, you may have gone around in circles with Representative Broad. I'll let you be the judge of that. I have the exact same concerns. You know, you stated that your goals are different than Representative Broad's or perhaps mine. You said you wanted to provide a balance of power, reduce gridlock, you want transparency. But I cannot for the life of me understand how you think that by having a written agreement by the Senate Majority Leader and President of the Senate and Speaker and Majority Leader of the House of Representatives, how that in any way provides a balance of power. You are giving the minority party absolutely no say in this. And if you're truly looking for transparency, you know, I'm not necessarily against what you're trying to do, but if you're serious about wanting transparency, if you're serious about providing a balance of power, you will include, and I hope you strongly consider this, and I know an amendment will be coming once this hits the House floor, you will include the minority party. Because I don't think that anybody out there, anybody that's watching this, anybody in the public, could look at you and say with all honesty that this bill, this legislation you're passing, in any way provides a balance of power. It doesn't. It simply doesn't. It's wrong. What we're doing is wrong, and it's the exact opposite of providing transparency. It's the exact opposite of providing a balance of power. There's no reason that you couldn't add those, and it could be a truly bipartisan effort. If for some reason the governor was not acting upon the best interest of Minnesota, whether he was a Democrat or a Republican, the legislative leaders could certainly be mature enough to get together and agree upon a special session. And the fact that you purposely exclude half of the equation and half of the basically half the people of Minnesota tells me that this is, you're not taking this seriously, and it's very frustrating. I'm not trying to be insulting, but this is personally offensive to me, because it is anything but what you say it is. And I just don't understand it, and I strongly hope you will consider changing this before it gets to the House floor, changing it so that all parties that are involved and so that the whole state is represented and not just one party.
Representative Pepin, would you like Representative Carlson to respond, or is that instructive?
Well, I guess my question would be, will you consider adding that as an amendment? And if not, why not?
Representative Carlson.
Well, I think I've responded to the question. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, you read part of the sentence. You didn't read the entire sentence. And I view it that I was being inclusive of the minority party, because when you reference the leadership of both bodies, if you read the entire sentence, then it also has to be approved then by the committees that are in charge of rules in both bodies. So that's where my intent was, to make sure that both the majority and the minority
follow up.
And other members, by the way, beyond just, we're talking here simply majority-minority, other members beyond simply the leadership in the two bodies are involved, and that's a broader group when you include the Rules Committee.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, I appreciate you saying that, but being included and actually having a say are two entirely different things. You know as well as I do that the makeup of the Rules Committee and any other committee is skewed in favor of the majority party. The minority party does not have the ability to change the outcome. And now I'm not criticizing either party for doing that. That's just the nature of the beast, which is why we should fix it for this amendment. I mean, I guess my question to you would be, you know, I looked at this article that you sent out, and I know it was 2 years old, from the Star Tribune, and I have it in front of me right now. Here it is. And it says, that would change under a bipartisan bill. And perhaps it was 2 years, but I'm wondering, Representative Carlson, if you could tell me how many co-authors you have on your bill and how many of them are from the minority party.
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall how many co-authors there are. We did send out an email to representatives of, or to the entire legislature, House members, and I don't think we had any response from the minority party. This time we did have a co-author for the bill 2 years ago.
Well, thank you,
Mr. But we did reach out for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. According to my information, this could be wrong, but you have no minority authors, but you have 17 majority co-authors, which to me should send a big, big red flag to you that this is not in any way providing a balance of power, because if this were truly bipartisan legislation, you would have minority co-authors, because if you had included both parties, it would have been a more fair piece of legislation, and I'm just really, really disappointed that that this is turning into the bipartisan mess that it is. So I guess I don't have any further comments for you, just frustration.
Mr. Chairman, I just can reiterate, we provided the opportunity for every member of the House to be a co-sponsor if they so chose.
Well, Representative Carlson, since I get to be chair, I get to interrupt the flow a little. In a democracy, usually a majority is supposed to rule, is it not? So doesn't seem to be an extremist position to argue that 50.1 would be able to move on issues, whether it's this one or some others. We see the problem at the federal levels, particularly in the Senate, where apparently now everything must move by supermajority. So just a comment. Representative Garofalo.
I concur with the comment,
Mr. Chairman. You just added added 45 minutes to the debate with that comment. Now, Chairman Carlson, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. I think that there are deep issues at play here, and I think the legislature should be discussing this. And the one suggestion I have, a couple of suggestions, but the first suggestion I have to you is that if there's one thing we learned in 2008, it's that voters don't read the entire ballot question. And it might be a good idea to not have the words legislature and special session in the very first sentence of the ballot question. Maybe we could write it's like, you know, in an effort to limit per diem payments to politicians or something like that, that maybe that might be a better way to go. But Chairman Carlson, I actually, in some of your philosophy on this, I agree that one of the things I've learned since I was elected is that the executive branch, the executive branch does have too much authority compared to the legislative branch, that we're supposed to be co-equal branches of government. And I think anyone who's been around here understands that the executive branch does have too much power. However, in my opinion, I am not interested in taking the concentrated political power of the executive branch and moving it to the concentrated political power of leaders of the legislative branch. I'm more interested in seeing rank-and-file members play a role in the process, and I respect the fact that you included the Rules Committee on it, but in your handout, you noted that many other states have a majority of the membership or supermajorities of the membership of the legislative chamber determine that, and I'm wondering if you could, I understand you included the Rules Committee, but what was the rationale for not including a supermajority of the membership to ensure, because not to put words in your mouth, but I'm understanding that you want to stop a renegade executive from holding the state hostage.
Representative Charles,
if you recall, in my introductory comments, one of my key points was avoiding gridlock. And so, if the majority party, quite frankly, felt that a special session was necessary, they could call the special session. But to do it in a broad enough way where it didn't include just the four leaders, but it also included the Rules Committee in both bodies. So I keep going back to those initial reasons: balance of power, transparency, avoiding gridlock. And so that would be my essential line of reasoning with that. And the other part of it that entered in, we have to keep in mind that we're not taking any authority away from any governor. The governor would still have the option of calling a special session. In fact, what I think realistically would happen is that before the legislature enacted it, there's probably a high degree of likelihood that the governor would call it, knowing that that power was housed within the legislature itself. The other thing is that the governor still has the power of veto. So if you had the legislature getting too far removed from what the governor would like to see happen, then the other powers that the governor currently has kick in. And if you called a special session and the governor were totally opposed to what the action of the legislature happened to be, the governor would still have the power to veto.
Sure.
So there are checks and balances retained with this. It just enhances the ability of the legislature to respond more timely to current issues. And quite frankly, I was, I think it was Houston, Minnesota, after the flood in southeastern Minnesota, down with Representative Houseman. We were in the gymnasium, there had been just horrendous, maybe it was Redford, I forget, maybe you can help me there, Representative Houseman, as to which one it was. The governor had been there, and the people wanted to know if there was going to be a special session, and apparently in his comments he'd been a little vague, and there was a lot of frustration in that community, and we walked around that community and the devastation was just unbelievable from that flood, and the people wanted an answer, and it would have been nice to have been able to say one entity or the other was going to call a special session to begin to resolve those flooding issues. If you saw the faces and the frustration in that gymnasium, you would understand what I'm saying.
And
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Carlson, and again, I just want to be clear that I think that you're bringing up an important issue that needs to be solved. And I'm not going to get into the Rushford situation because I think the public was being misinformed about what a special session really would do and what it would mean, but I want to stay away from the details of that. I just want to let you know that when this bill comes to the floor, I'm going to be offering an amendment to actually disagree with my Republican colleagues. I have no interest in having the minority leader of either party own my vote. I'm looking for the rank and file, like a supermajority, to have this power, again, to reduce the risk of a renegade executive holding the state hostage. And if we allow the leadership to have to sign off on this stuff, we could be in a situation where we could have a majority leader or a speaker or a president of the Senate withholding their signature until they get something that they want for their district. And I just don't think that's a good place to be. But I do think your heart is in the right spot. And this brings up a serious discussion that we should be having about the system of checks and balances we have in our government. And I thank you for bringing it forward.
Well, thank you.
Representative Carlson. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Garofalo setting that stage because it sort of leads into my point. I think we do a disservice to this bill if our debate focuses on partisan division, because I don't think anything about the bill reflects the issue of partisan division. The bill raises the question of whether one person should govern the state or whether all elected representatives should govern the state. I do believe that the public presumes that we have three equal branches of government. And there's perhaps been a little bit of understanding now with the issue of vetoes that if a legislature doesn't have a veto-proof majority, the governor does, in fact, have more power in the legislative process as well. But I do believe that all those kids who went through school and read their civics textbook thought that three equal branches of government led to this system of checks and balances. But now we can only govern if the governor decides we can. I mean, that's in effect what the status quo is. We can only govern in certain portions of the year. The governor can veto year-round, but we can only govern in crucial points if the governor decides. It's really about the legislative role. Should it be about our ability to shape our own decision-making? Should we be able to decide when we meet in order to reflect the wishes of those we represent? It is ultimately about voters' power. Voters determine who comes here to govern, and they are only represented when a majority of those elected here govern. And one of the things the majority of those elected do is elect leaders. If we don't acknowledge the role of voters and what they and the outcome of elections in what we do here, we really subvert the very essence of what democracy is, to shape an ordered society that doesn't deteriorate into chaos. So I think the at essence here is it's sort of should one person govern year-round, or should all elected representatives elected by voters have that opportunity?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the point that I make here, and I think I hear your stated goals and the balance of power and all of that, but when I look at the handout that you have, you know, and I think the issue is not the concept. As you know, many of us, we may support a bill and its concept, but oppose it because of how it's written. So language does matter. And when you get no minority members willing to be authors, it may have to do with how it's written. And so this is an example of how you might go forward under this. In how the process and how you get there is an example of how you would do it if you had that authority. And so it tells me that here's the bill, this is how it's written, take it or leave it. But I think that we are exercising our ability to as legislators in this process. But I was noticing in the handout that there are five columns, and 10 states use a majority of members, 5 use 3/5, 2/3 use 14, 1 uses 3/4, but only 5 use exclusively presiding officers only, Delaware, Illinois, Ohio, and Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is not a state, last that I recall. So there are 3 states then that have presiding officers only. And even if you include the Rules Committee, which again, since the presiding officers carry the votes in those committees as well, you're probably having maybe the equivalent of 5% of the members of the legislature making this decision. So I would just really encourage you to listen to the minority members now in the process of crafting this constitutional amendment so that we establish the process, and also I think the way it is written that would gain you that kind of support.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just in answer to all of the people who are complaining about fiscal notes, we have no fiscal note for the governor's without bounds authority to call special sessions. As we've talked, as we said, the only time that multiple ones were called, they were called by a governor continually as they were needed. And so, you know, with the lack of needing any fiscal note for prediction for the governor to call a special session, I don't understand why we would need one for the legislature to call a special session. And I guess Representative Carlson and I, perhaps, were the only people here when a Democratic speaker was elected by a majority of Republican votes in the House of Representatives. I believe we were on, with our ability to remember everything, we were on opposite sides of that of that contest. But there's a lot of interesting bipartisan actions that occur in the previous history of this body. So it's not necessarily the as uniform as it might look.
Representative Coles, to that point.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I have a lot to say about this bill. I'm gonna reserve a lot of it for the floor. But Representative Kahn, you know, the one of the significant differences is that while the governor certainly has the ability to call a special session and can call repeated special sessions, we the legislature decide when we are done. We decide when we go home. Under this bill, we can stick around for 7 days, and then we can come back and be around for another 7 days, and then we can be around for another 7 legislative days. And each one of those is $252,714 under the fiscal note if all members claim their per diem. And so you're right. The governor, there is no fiscal note, and I understand that. And, you know, I'm going to save the rest of my comments other than to note I really do believe that this is a step toward a moving away from a citizen legislature and toward a full-time legislature, which I don't think is the direction that the citizens of Minnesota want us to go or that I think we should go. Mr. Chair, I'm going to do something we don't typically do in this committee, but I am going to ask for a roll call on the final vote before we pass it out.
Roll call has been called. Representative Steinman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think this is a great debate to have. I'm sure we'll have it on the floor if this gets through on the floor. My view of it is that, you know, you talk about strong mayors and weak mayor system. We have a very strong governor system in this state. And you look at the news and weak mayor system, we have a very strong governor system in this state. And you look at the things that a governor, not this governor, but a governor has, starting with the ability, the sole ability to call a special session, the line item veto, the apparent ability for now to unallot, vast appointment powers, the fact that we're a part-time legislature, which means 8 months out of the year, you know, he's got the spotlight exclusively while we're all home living our lives. I mean, this is a governorship, I'm not saying this governor, that has a lot of power compared to other states, it seems to me. And this seems like a reasonable way to bring back a little bit of balance here. About the only thing I can think of where, compared to other states, from what I've seen, we in the legislature have some pretty extraordinary power, and Representative Rukavina knows about this, is the regent process. I don't think there are too many other states that choose it like we do, where the legislature really does. Other than that, I think the governor in the state, if you were to make an analogy to a city, it's a strong governor system. And so I don't think we're in any danger here passing this and making the governor of Minnesota into a weakling. He or she is always going to have a lot of real extensive powers. This just seems to put a lot of balance back in the system. The other kind of balance that we obviously always talk about is partisan balance. And, you know, if you just rewind for a few years ago when we had a Republican House and a DFL Senate, this probably wouldn't be an issue. And some of the concerns being raised here probably wouldn't be an issue. It would probably be unlikely that then Speaker Swigum and then Senate Majority Leader Johnson would agree on the terms of the special session. So I don't think things are frozen in time. Party control switches in terms of the legislative bodies and the governor. This seems to me like a reasonable way to put balance back into a system, which now I think pretty objectively favors the chief executive.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish Representative Garofalo hadn't left, because I found his comment about the voters not reading the ballot question to be unfortunate. I think it goes directly to the debate here, because what we're doing is asking the voters to make a decision and giving them something that they can choose to on whether or not there's a good balance of powers in the state of Minnesota. And this debate that we've had on allotment and other things, I think the public has been engaged, and I think this is a fine time for them to weigh in on whether they think we have that balance of power. Roughly 100 years ago, we had on the ballot a question of whether the governor would have the power to reduce spending. Not the veto, not the line item veto, but whether the governor would have unilateral power to reduce spending. And the voters rejected that. They're fully capable of making a decision on how the powers in state government should be balanced, and I don't know why we would stand in the way of sending them a bill that would allow them to do that. And that also goes to the point about the Rules Committee being involved, because that's actually an opportunity for public testimony. To actually have a committee involved in the discussion allows the public to weigh in on whether or not a special session is necessary in a particular instance. And I'd frankly much rather hear from the public than my fellow members on whether a special session is warranted. So I think having public testimony with the final leadership decision and final responsibility for that decision is a good way of putting this together. And finally, on the legacy amendment that Representative Garofalo, I think, was referencing, I just think it's worth noting that that passed with the most number of votes that any person or anything has ever received in the state of Minnesota. And to say that it passed because people don't read the ballot question in full is a fairly arrogant thing to say.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Carlson, we've heard the comments of the conservative members here who have concerns about fiscal note, the cost of running special sessions on a daily basis and so forth. And the comments I hear from a lot of my constituents is, you know, if you don't get your work done in the allotted legislative session, there should be no payment for legislators during a special session. Is there any consideration for eliminating per diem for members during the special session?
Representative Carlson.
Not in the amendment. You know, the way that has operated historically, whether it's called by the, or when it's called by the, it's the only way you have a special session is that's up to the individual member whether he or she wants to draw per diem. I would only point out that when we talk about per diem and reimbursements during a special session, I think, and this gets into a little different discussion, but we have to keep in mind that Minnesota is a large state, and members come in from all over the state. If it's a special session, they're probably leaving their regular world of work, and they don't typically attend a special session to make money. I think if you didn't have per diem available, it would probably fall harder on some of the greater Minnesota legislators than some of us from the metro area, but that would be a discussion that the Rules Committee would have when they set per diem generally as to under what circumstances you can draw it.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Carlson moves House File 2577, the first committee engrossment, to recommend it to pass and re-refer to the committee in Ways and Means. All those in favor? That's right. We have to have a roll call.
Carlson?
Aye.
Benson?
Aye.
Broad?
No.
Champion?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Emmer?
No.
Groppel? Greiling? Hackbarth? Hausman?
Yes.
Hilty?
Aye.
Howes? Huntley?
Aye.
Junkie?
Aye.
Kahn?
Aye.
Kiffmeyer?
Aye. I'm sorry. No.
Knuth?
Aye.
You wanted to.
Coles?
No.
And Chesky?
Aye.
Paymar?
Aye.
Kolowski?
Aye.
Pepin?
No.
Rukavina?
Aye.
Szymanski?
No.
Simon?
Aye.
Slavik?
Aye.
Smith? Solberg?
Aye.
Thiessen?
No.
Wagenius?
Aye.
Winkler?
Aye.
Murphy?
Well, yes.
Yes.
His leader.
On the other side, return. The result of the vote, 20 ayes, 7 nays, the motion prevails.
Well, thank you. It's been a good discussion. Mr. Chairman, I have the next bill up as well, and maybe this one will go a little bit easier.
Okay. Representative Rukavina, House File 3739. You'll move the bill, please.
This is Representative. I move the division report. You recommend it to pass. Whatever else I'm supposed to move.
Representative Rukavina moves the Higher Education Workforce Development Policy Finance Division Report for House File 3739. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that House File 3739 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Representative Carlson, if you present your bill.
Mr. Chairman, this deals with the self-loan program, which is a loan program available to college and university students. House File 3739 modifies the statutory language to increase the ongoing tax-exempt revenue bond allocation for the self-student loan program from $10 million each year to $25 million each year. The increase in tax-exempt authority would improve the Office of Higher Education's ability to maintain moderate interest rates for student borrowers. The self-loan is a state-sponsored student loan program primarily for the Minnesota students who need assistance paying for education beyond high school. The self-loan is a long-term, low-interest educational loan administered by the Office of Higher Education, as I mentioned earlier, and the SELF program has provided over $1.7 billion in loans to students since 1984. In fact, in 1984, I was the original author of the SELF loan program here in the Minnesota House. So it's interesting to see the success of the program. This bill also authorizes state agencies receiving allocations of tax-exempt revenue bonding the authority to transfer them among three agencies that receive allocations with the approval of the Minnesota management and budget. The three agencies where it could be reallocated then would be the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority. The amount of tax-exempt revenue bonds for mortgage bonds, public facility bonds, residential resident rental bonds, and other purposes in Minnesota and other states is limited by the IRS. Minnesota's total allocation from the IRS for 2009 was $469 million.
With that, Mr. Chairman, what we're doing then is increasing, basically to sum it up, we're increasing the availability of self-loans to make sure students have available low-interest loans. And the testimony in the division was that the federal loans that a student would have would be, I think, currently 6.8%. Currently, with these tax-exempt loans, a student would pay, and this, of course, we all know the market changes, but currently, I think it was testified by Hesel that it would be 3.8%. So that's what we're providing is low-interest loans for students and enabling them to hopefully complete their education.
Any discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Carlson renews his motion that House File 3739 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Winkler will go back to House File 2754. Representative Kahn, would you move House File 2754,
yes,
the Winkler bill, please?
The State Government Finance Division report for House File 2754.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2754 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Very, very challenging and difficult bill in front of us, members. It eliminates $150 filing fee for declarations of trust, which are almost never filed, and the cost of putting them into the software system would be prohibitively expensive for the amount of money brought in. And we've got this piece of language from 1906 in which we charge 15 cents per folio for a document that's almost never filed at the Secretary of State's office. If anybody knows what folio is without looking at their bill brief, I'd be amazed. So this Section 2 just changes the filing fee to a flat $50, which is consistent with other Secretary of State filings.
Any discussion? Seeing none. Whoops. Oh, there we have one. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I just, Representative Winkler, I was, you know, in reading this and seeing that it was done so rarely, so the filing fee was zero in regards to Section 1.
No.
In Section 2, it also said the filing, that it's very rare, but the filing fee was just changed, you know, the folio term to a flat 50. It seems that if the rationale for Section 1 were carried through to Section 2, why wouldn't you just remove both fees and under the same kind of rationale? Why would you keep the second fee and just change it from the folio of 100 words to a flat fee of 50 if they're both so rarely done, and that seems to be the case? Why not just remove them both? Just curious. Maybe there's a reason here or something that I would benefit from hearing your explanation.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler.
I think the question is best addressed to Beth Frazier from the Secretary of State's office.
Welcome to committee. If you identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And Representative Kiffmeyer, that's a good question. I think that the answer has to do with service of process. And all of the service of process is done through our business center. And that's where filings with fees go. And so it makes sense to keep it there and keep the fees consistent for similar filings, whereas a fee with one without a fee goes through our open appointments, which is a totally kind of different part of the office.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that's right, that service of process. Okay, so I think that has a validity, but the one other thing, though, is that there is a... the fiscal note doesn't seem to include Section 2 as far as its current annual revenue that it brings in or future revenue. And so it seems as though under the, it's on page three of the fiscal note. So it has zero. So I'm just curious. It seems like it would be Maybe it is so rare that it's zero. Nonetheless, it just seemed a little.
Representative Winkler.
Might be an explanation also.
Representative Winkler or Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think it's because the office hasn't received one of those filings since 2005.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Okay, that is indeed rare then.
Any further discussion on House File 2754? Seeing none, then Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 2754 be recommended for passed and referred to the Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, motion prevails. For committee's information, House File 3754, the healthy bill will not be heard today. 3757, right. Okay. Representative Rukavina's bill is next, House File 3448.
Chair, members,
Representative Rukavina.
I'd move Higher Education and Workforce Development Division report for House File 3448.
Representative Rukavina moves House File 3448, the Higher Education Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division report, the first committee engrossment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Representative Rukavina.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, I'd move the bill be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Rukavina, I see there are amendments. They're not yours, so why don't you just move ahead and present your bill?
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, the bill basically is similar to the omnibus policy bill that I think has been sitting in this committee for quite a while. There's really nothing controversial in here. A lot of it is parts of Representative McFarland's bill that I believe the Office of Higher Education wanted. Representative Poppe has a few things in here regarding the central office that we had discussion on. Probably the most controversial part of it is Section 8 on page 5, where we are limiting the or putting caps on the two-year and four-year for-profit institutions for the state grant program into in an attempt to have some fairness. And I think probably on page 6, the summer bridge program, which hasn't started yet, I might add, that the House bill, finance bill, contained language eliminating this program before it started, but now we're just taking it out and giving it a $1 million appropriation so it doesn't subtract from the other grants that are going to be prorated because prorated reductions because of the 40-some million dollar hole we already have in the overuse of the state grant program because of the economy. So basically, members, that's the bill. There's really not that much controversial other than what I just told you, and so I'd appreciate your support. And then there's the amendments that I don't.
Right.
They're not mine.
Representative Jung.
Well, Mr. Chair, and maybe to Representative Carlson or Representative Mark or Representative Marks. Sorry, you don't need the pay cut.
I did it too.
Both this bill and the bill coming up, I don't see fiscal notes in our file folder. And I know when I brought my omnibus policy bill, you waited till we had fiscal notes. So I see nothing here. This is a fiscal committee. Can someone respond why we're not seeing notes on this? And in particular, the next one, maybe it's coming when we get to it, Wagenius. There's all kinds of fees and fines and other things in there, and there's no fiscal note in our file folder.
Mr. Marks, maybe you'll discuss that.
Mr. Chair, there's no money in it.
Well,
reduction of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, there will be a fiscal note on the next bill.
On this one, that was our understanding, is there is no money.
Okay. No money or no policy that would drive any fiscal...
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, yes.
All right.
Representative Clark, do you want to present your Amendment A-8?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the A-8 amendment, and I can explain to you what this is. This is a amendment that asks for our universities and the Minsky organizations to report back to the appropriate committees on what they're doing in terms of nanotechnology, what are the principles, the guiding principles, and the ethical issues that they're considering. I do have a slight verbal amendment that I'd like to include in this, Mr. Chairman, if you wouldn't mind. On line 1.8.
Line 1.8.
After the word education, please insert economic development, comma, environment. And Mr. Chairman, what that does is just...
All right, so we can just incorporate that
if you would, I'd appreciate incorporating that. Right. And what that does basically is ensure that two of the other appropriate committees of the legislature would receive information from our universities and colleges about nanotechnology, what they're doing. Members, let me just say that what I wanted to do here is to make sure that since we are investing quite a bit of money in nanotechnology, I think $4 million in the bonding bill, we're encouraging nanotechnology on many levels at all of our different institutions. We need to find out what the guiding principles are that they are operating under. This is a very powerful science, and it can create a lot of good, and it can also have potential for harm. And so we need to make sure that those issues are discussed and that they're reported to the appropriate committees at the legislature.
Before we go on, let's make sure everyone in the committee understands the oral amendment. On line 1.8, it should read, with responsibility for higher education, then we insert economic development and environment and for the public health, mm-hmm. etc. Right. Any further discussion on the amendment?
I'm fine with it, Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, then all those in favor of the amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? No. Amendment is adopted. Representative Huntley, I believe, has A-12.
I'll start with the A-11.
Is there an A-11? We don't have that one.
A-11 and A-12.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have A-11.
Yes, we're getting those. We don't have it either.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Heffmeyer.
Thank you. In regards to the First Amendment, we did put on, though, this nanotechnology report. Is there a fiscal note with this as well? Yeah, I'm reading through this and saying, this is a tremendous amount of work. This is not, all the things
Mr.
that are mentioned
Chair.
Here. So, or do you do this and then after, if it's included, then...
All right. Representative Rukavina or Clark?
Representative Kipmeyer, I think Representative Clark talked to both the university and Minsky, and they didn't have a problem with that.
That's right. Mr. Yeah. Chairman, as a matter of fact, I asked the questions about these. We can have, if you want to hear from them, we can have them describe that. I asked them if they had any difficulty with it, with the amendment. They said no. They had offered, actually, the university had offered during some hearings to actually brief me on this. It never happened. So I want to make sure that it does happen, and that's why I'm putting it into this legislation. It's a matter of providing some information about what they say they already have in place, some principles and guidelines. And just for your information, Mr. Chairman, there is going to be a conference, I guess, this weekend at the university on nanotechnology. So tomorrow. It's a very timely amendment. We're asking them to report to us what they're beginning to talk about, you know, more publicly in general.
So, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to just affirm then, for the record, then, and what you're saying then is that they are absorbing the cost. When they say they don't have any problem with it, that could be the policy of it, but financially also, they're saying they'll do this without additional cost, right?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm not comfortable saying that they said they'll absorb the cost. I didn't hear those words from them. Maybe that would be something I could ask them right now. Some of them are in the room, or you could ask them, but... I would assume they would, but let's not assume it if you need to have that on the record.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think if they are in the room and wish to, if they want to take more time and think about that, I respect whatever they want to share here. Didn't want to just really put them on the spot unless they were prepared.
Well, they're here.
All right.
Is there a representative of the commission? Welcome to committee, if you identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Donna Peterson, University of Minnesota. When the legislature has requested the university to do a study or a report back to the legislature and how we do our business within the university, we have complied with those reports and have not asked for funding for doing those reports.
Welcome to committee, if you identify yourself.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Leslie Mercer. I'm Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Planning at the University at the Minnesota State College and University System. I think my answer would be very similar to that of the University of Minnesota. This is something that we would just plan to do. It's information that we're gathering anyway, and so we are comfortable with this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That answers my question. Thank you.
Right. Representative Huntley, Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to make one comment on the technology, on the nanotechnology conference that Representative Clark referenced. I get all of these by email because I'm part of a board that that governs, that is responsible for this. I usually send them to all the members of the legislature notice and staff notice of these conferences. I probably didn't do this one because an all-day conference starting tomorrow looked as if it probably wasn't going to be accessible for most of us. So,
Representative Huntley, since we're waiting on the other amendment, would you move A-12 at this point?
Mr. Chair, I would move the A-12 amendment.
And
Mr. Chair, this was brought to me actually yesterday. by a retired extension service person that was high up in the university extension service. A lot of people don't even know that the extension service is actually a university function, and that they do many things other than just involved with agricultural business. They do all kinds of things in various counties and advise people on them. And since the university is constitutionally independent, all this does is request that the university direct its extension service people to conduct public education in the various counties related to the changes that are need to happen because of the federal health care reform bills.
Any discussion? Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley discussed this with me yesterday, and I think it's a good idea.
Any further discussion on the A-12 amendment? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read the language here, and I think conducting public education is one thing, but I noticed here, though, that it's only the potential benefits of federal health care reform. And, you know, in that bill, there is a $500 billion reduction to Medicaid, Medicare. I think maybe they should also be educated about the other kinds of potential consequences of what that act includes. I mean, I think there should be full disclosure of both the pros and cons in regards to what may be in that bill, and to just have it only be one-sided, to give only the benefits without the balance to it, seems a little skewed here, that we'd be actually using the extension to kind of almost be like a campaign committee just telling about the good things about a bill.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I guess when I read this language, I don't look at this as a discussion of civics on the merits of the health care legislation, but it's to give people information that they might need about federal programs and other kinds of health benefits that they might receive and might not otherwise have ready access information about. So it's more about informing them about federal benefits available under law rather than to have a civic discussion about the merits of the health care reform package.
Any further discussion on the A-12 amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, Representative Winkler. That's kind of exactly my point. that it should be basic information of just what is there, not describing it as potential benefits. As soon as you use that, you are then giving a different purpose to it. So I think you make my point very well, but maybe we can continue that discussion as it moves forward to the next committee.
Any further discussion on the 812 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Huntley, we now have the A11 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this relates to what are called surgical technologists, and these are people that work in a operating room with the physicians and the anesthesiologists and the nurses that are in there, and currently there's no requirement that the people that do this have been certified or have the training that that would be required, and there's been many studies, one by the Minnesota Department of Health, that showed that the really bad errors that happen in operating rooms, like operating on the wrong leg, there's a 30% reduction if they have hired certified surgical technologists to help the surgeons in the operating room. What this bill does is simply set up a system whereby the six MNSCU programs around the state that train these can have a pilot project with neighboring hospitals and to continue the training of these people and hopefully make sure that that in the future people will be certified. There's nothing in this that mandates anything. It simply says ask the MNSCU system to set up these coordinating programs with various hospitals if they choose to do so. It's been supported by the American certifying these individuals is supported by the American College of Surgeons. I've passed out a letter from MNSCU supporting this amendment, and I can also tell you that the reason it's going on to a Rukavina bill is that it's also supported by the steelworkers. And one of the lesser-known facts about the steelworkers is that I think they have more people working in the healthcare industry than they do in the steel industry.
Sad commentary, American industry. Any further discussion on the A11 amendment?
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I make one amendment on line one? Where's the red one? On line 1.25, after the word any, insert participating. So it would say any participating healthcare facility.
Did anyone need that repeated? So it would be an oral amendment. We'll incorporate that into the amendment.
And Mr. Chair, that gets that makes the that line 125 basically the same as line 118 in terms of the definition.
Representative Clark.
Just a question. I support this amendment. I ran across the group that was meeting to talk about this over the Capitol and was pretty astounded as a nurse to learn that there were people in the operating room who had no license, who were actually sewing up people and doing all the kinds of things that these folks do. And I did have some questions with them about, you know, what is the relationship to the other occupations in the operating theater, and I don't think I still understand the answer to that very well. For example, some of the nurses and others, and I don't know if nurses are in agreement with this or not. I think it's very important we do that. What this is about. I do have one question, which is those folks who are now doing the work but are not licensed, will they... I think they'll be grandmothered in, but are they going to also need to then get licensed?
Representative Hunt.
Or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, they could still work. Anybody that's currently employed in any of these six hospitals around the state would still be allowed to do that work. This is just imply that, and again, everything is voluntary in this, so that they would hopefully get the training and pass the test that makes them certified. And I will say that most of the big hospital systems in this state basically require this already. They only hire people that are certified.
Okay, I'm just interested in maybe continuing to learn a little bit more about the opportunities for those folks who are already doing the work to get the certification, because it seems like it is a safety factor.
Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Huntley. Just quickly reading the amendment, is there any requirement for any underlying certificates or degrees, such as a nursing degree or anything, before becoming a surgical technologist?
No, yeah, but and there is a line in here. It says any licensed practitioner. It's line 121 and 122. That means that this does not, anything in this bill does not apply to physician's assistants or nurses that are already licensed by their thing to do this kind of work. So they're excluded. Students are excluded from needing this, and it is voluntary in terms of the hospital.
Any further discussion on the A11 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion then that 3448 as amended.
Excuse me, Representative Rukavina, I think there are two others that want to visit here. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rukavina, I'm curious on page 5, section 8, the subdivision 6 on cost of attendance. I'm looking at that, and to me it reads that it will have a, because you're changing how the calculations are figured out for financial aid, I'm guessing that that'll result in smaller financial aid awards to those who go to a private or career college, because of how the calculations are changing. If you're basing it on a public school tuition instead of a private school tuition, obviously that will have an impact. And I'm wondering if anybody had testified, or if you knew how much that might have impact on the average student that goes to a private school or a career college. And also I'm wondering if anybody from like a career college association or a private college association had testified on this bill or testified as to what the impact might be.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, on this particular bill, no, but on the previous bill where we had also had caps when the finance bill left the House of Representatives here before Easter break, there was, testimony certainly not in support. But what I'm trying to do is reduce the reduction for 90,000 students and put a cap on the for-profits, which has, seen a significant growth in for-profit colleges, and just cap them at the same with this. Actually, this is nicer language than the previous language, because I had in there that the four-year programs are tied to the average of a state university, which I believe is $6,900 or so dollars. My committee administrator is nodding her head. And so it's actually better than the language was that you may or may not have voted for as it left the House before.
Representative Pepin, any further?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and hope you don't hold the students responsible who are just trying to pay for college at the college they chose, but or the Chair. Technical school or whatever. But I do have a question. Was there any testimony? I'm just curious, too, as if there was an average dollar amount given for either a career college or a private school association as to what that might look like. Would it be $2,000 per year, $5,000? What might that grant? Or maybe it hasn't been calculated, but I'm just wondering if anybody had given a number when they testified.
Ms. Novak may be able to know, so we did have some numbers, but... Okay. Currently, the 2 years are capped at the highest Minsky institution, but the 4 years are basically the same as the University of Minnesota and the private not-for-profit. So this would have an effect of dropping the four-year about $1,400 and the two-year about $400. But I don't know what income level that is at, or if it even makes a difference as to the income level. But I just want the committee to know that right now 90,000 students are losing, I think about 12,000 students in the state grant program are dropping off if we don't do anything, and about 90,000 are going to have, or 83,000 then would have their grants reduced, prorated under current law. That's why I mentioned to you, Representative Pepin, that I was trying to, the bridge program, to put it outside the state grant program and have $1 million cap on it, and then do this so that the other 80-some thousand students have less of a reduction than they will be getting under current law.
Thank you. I was just kind of concerned about enrollment and what kind of implication that might be, because we probably all had some constituents come in and testify that they,
honest with you, they don't like it, but, you know, we do have to do something because we got this $43 million hole, and Representative Carlson has tried to address it a little bit, Representative Hilty, but you probably won't like the way they're trying to address it either. So we'll have that discussion at another day.
Yeah, thanks for your thoughts.
Representative Pemar.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, I'm not on higher ed, but could you just, in 30 seconds, explain Section 33? I'm just wondering, did that come from MNSCU? I guess there's three questions. Did that come from MNSCU? Why we're doing this, and there's an evaluation process that looks at the possible effectiveness of depositing these reserve accounts in community institutions, which it's fine, but also talks about the potential harm. So I'm just trying to get at why we're doing this, and why we need legislative approval to do it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Pemar, one of the things we talked about at the on that jobs committee was this particular issue, where the small state chartered banks had talked about keeping some state reserves in local area banks so that money could be lended out again. And so this is a pilot project to see if that actually will work. And we need legislation, I guess, because currently, if I'm not mistaken, maybe somebody from MNSCU, that money would go into the MNSCU reserves and be invested, I suppose, daily or whenever by the Board of Investment or in short-term investments. So this is just a way to see if around the state, if like the tuition that's being paid for by the local students, some of that could stay locally in the local bank and maybe be borrowed to a business that currently there isn't a cash at that facility to loan. So that was recommended by one of the local St. Paul bankers who happens to sit on the Board of Regents. And this was a recommendation that we try something like this. So.
Representative Paymont.
Probably your constituent. Go ahead and vote against them. I don't.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so this didn't come from MNSCU.
Representative Rukavina.
Much of the stuff in my bill doesn't come from MNSCU.
I just want to make sure that there's no downside to, because this is all a mandate on community colleges.
I think the local community colleges might be, supportive of it. I don't know. I don't think MNSCU was totally against it, and I see somebody here that they're okay with it. They're putting thumbs up to me.
All right.
Representative Knuth.
Just very quickly, just to confirm, Representative Rukavina, you're talking about with the section Representative Pepin was referring to, for-profit private institutions. Like, I represent Bethel, they're a not-for-profit private institution. It doesn't affect their calculations. I just want confirmation right on that.
Representative Rukavina.
That is correct, Representative.
Any further discussion Seeing none, then Representative Rukavina renews his motion that House File 3448, the first committee engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Member.
Representative Wagenius. House File 3702. Our favorite one, it's the last one. If you would like to move your bill, please.
We're going to test that. We're just going to give it a shot and see what happens.
I would like to move House File 3702 and that it be recommended to pass.
Representative Wagenius moves Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division report for House File 3702, the first committee engrossment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion passes. Representative Wagenius.
Right. I do have an author's amendment.
You need to move the bill, too.
Okay. Oh, yes. I need to move House File 3702.
All right. All right. And then we have a author's amendment. Does everyone have that?
No.
A-16. We'll wait for those to be passed out.
Some of us are
Do you want to explain the amendment? And then when they're passed out, we'll vote on it.
All right. I think people are getting the amendment right now.
Or would you like to explain the bill first and then go to the amendment?
We can do either one. Why don't I explain the bill first,
All right.
And then we'll go to the amendment. All right. This is the 2010 Environment Finance Omnibus Bill. I'm going to read the list of bills included and describe them. All have some financial implication, but in many, many cases, it's very minimal. And Mr. Reinholz, I hope, is here. We didn't get the fiscal note on this until last night at 8 o'clock, so I'm going to have to depend on our good fiscal analyst to help me out with some of this. The original House File 3702 was my legislation. It was written in response to the legislative auditor's report that essentially said that DNR in many of its sections needed long-term plans for land management, similar to the ones that we had already done for parks and trails as a result of language that we did in Representative Murphy's committee last year. And so the new areas would be wildlife management, state forests, scientific natural areas, aquatic management areas, public water access sites, and prairie bank easements. That's essentially, that was the original bill. The others joined in this omnibus bill. The second bill that you'll see in here is Representative Saylor's bill, which was House File 3207, which increased ski trail pass fees daily from $4 to $5. There's also an other dollar surcharge, and $14 to $19 annually. And provides an exception for school activities. This was brought to us by the folks who do skiing, and they didn't have enough money to do grooming. House File 2622 is Representative Cornish's bill. In it, he designates the Blue Earth River as a boating route. There is $60,000 for the water rec account to mark all of the state water trails now. We're calling them state water trails. Representative Conan had a bill, 2957, where Indian tribal governments are exempted from registering or licensing watercraft, off-highway vehicles, and snowmobiles. They're treated the same as the U.S. or the state of Minnesota. There's minimal fiscal impact of this. Representative Bunn's House File 3367 was a clarification of her 2008 bill. It substantially slims it down and makes it clear that applies only to new landfills and not to current ones. House File 2673 is Representative Detmer's bill. Currently, we permanent and total disabled veterans can come into our parks for free. This expands this partially, and this is for any disabled veteran, but now has to be a resident, and it's only for day passes. It was very hard for DNR to come up with a fiscal note for this. We are carrying $130,000, and it's going to be closely monitored to see what this is, the cost to parks is. There are two DNR technical bills. One was carried by Representative Dill, that one has savings, and DNR was looking for savings. I'm not sure that there's as much savings as we as they're posting, but it's good for them for working for savings. Part of it is to allow for general burning permits from some of our counties who will adopt their own provisions, and the general burning permits will allow DNR to concentrate on areas of high fire danger rather than on areas of low fire danger. And there's some timbers, some Forest Service fees established and modified, and some timber sales provisions that talk about tracts that are unsold at the first go-round will have a second go-round and can be offered at below appraised value. House File 3094's Representative Eakin's technical bill has very little financial implication. Representative Hackbarth had House File 3190, and again, he modified some off-highway vehicles seasons with minimal financial impact. Representative Saylor had a bill where we took part of the bill, House File 3291, this is waiving some fees for the DNR charges for utility crossings, and if it's for a resident and there are multiple crossings, telephone, electricity, whatever, crossings of public land, they'll all be included in one fee instead of multiple fees. Representative Saylor had another bill, House File 3495. This is a Peace in the Valley bill, where local ordinance adoption of subsurface sewer treatment systems is delayed until PCA has finally adopted its new rules, and they have 10 months afterward. Then Representative Portman had House File 3097, and this we partially adopted that, providing for customized EAWs to make it easier for folks to fill out and do EAWs, have them up electronically, and then be received electronically. And with that, members, that is the bill, and I would offer if the amendment, I think that's easier than getting questions first, and the amendment is House File A-16.
Okay, Representative Wiginius, will you explain your amendment?
Yes. the first section, 43, is about peace officer training account. We're placing some revenue from a portion of the church surcharges assessed to criminal and traffic offenders, and we're putting it in a peace officer training for employees of the Department of Natural Resources. This is something we would have normally carried in Representative Carlson's omnibus finance bill that we've already passed, but it was language, and so we deferred it to here. On line
1.14, this is clarifying that the 2008 law, as it applies to new landfills, also applies to new assurance rules. So the law only applies to the new. Then we go down the page and we're back to the peace officer training. It's just clarifying that. And then in page 2.23, this comes as a discussion with Representative Reiling and Representative Dietrich, the concern by the Education Committee that the school trust lands are not receiving the money that they should be receiving from the DNR. And this is a complicated issue, members, and it's very hard to debate it based on theory. So what we're going to do is be getting a lot of facts. And the model here is going to be the one we used in Representative Murphy's committee when we did the DNR Parks and Trails, and we're trying to figure out their long-term management. And we put it in statute that they were to give us some long-term management plans, and it was difficult for them to do it. But after two tries, our fiscal analyst, Mr. Reinholz, took the project on and continued to get information from DNR and was able to come up with spreadsheets that everybody could understand, and we knew exactly what was going on. Made it so much easier for us to make decisions. And I have to say, it's those spreadsheets that were applauded by the legislative auditor. So we're going to try the same thing here. And we're also going to ask DNR to give us, and this is, I'm looking on page 3 now, at the top of page 3, to give us some recommendations for a funding mechanism for compensating the school trust fund for the public use of school trust lands for outdoor recreation. And what I'm looking at there, members, is we have a lot of hunting and fishing on school trust lands. We don't know how much, though. We don't know where they are. And there is no compensation from a Game and Fish Fund or any other DNR account to the school trust funds for activity on that land. And so we are going to get the information we need to figure out how to do that. On 3.8, this is a Coon Rapids Dam Commission, something I would not have ordinarily brought to a finance committee. We would have done it in our own committee. But here's the Coon Rapids problem, and we tried to solve it in another way, and it didn't work. Coon Rapids Dam is all that needs fixing, but from the Environment Committee's point of view, it's probably our best barrier to the Asian fish coming up the Mississippi River. It's the last barrier. So from our point of view, that dam has to be kept in good shape. So we recommended to the bonding committee, and the bonding committee put in money for working on fixing up that dam so there's not the undercutting that would allow the Asian carp to get up. And the governor line item vetoed that provision for the dam money. I will never understand that, but the alternative is to revisit that issue with this commission. And this is the language that Representative Portman brought to me, and I am bringing to you to work on that. So with that, that's the amendment, and I would move the amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like it.
Discussion on the A-16 amendment, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius, I have a question on the creation, well, Section 43, this creation of the Peace Officer Training Account. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm trying to find out where your which portion of the surcharge you're using to create this for the Department of Natural Resources. Maybe you can answer that question first, and then I have a few more questions as to the process for getting to this point.
Representative Wagenius.
This is, as I understand it, and I'm going to ask our fiscal analyst to help me out here.
As I understand it,
this has been in place, but the money was not spent, and it was just sitting there. We had $900,000, if I remember correctly, that was taken and put in Representative Carlson's bill because the money had not been allocated, and now we are allocating it. And Mr. Ryan,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Baymark.
Well, unless this is the 1% that I see in statute that goes to the DNR.
Yes.
But if this is the 39% that goes to the post board, then we have a very different question to consider.
Mr. Reinholz is going
to... Mr. Reinholz, will you introduce yourself for the record?
Please? Jim Reinholz, fiscal analyst with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. It is the 1%. To answer your question, Representative Paymar, it is the 1%. And you can see it more clearly if you look down in beginning on line 123. That's where we're actually amending 357.021. If you follow that over to page 2, you'll see on lines 2.1 to 2.3 that what it's doing is taking that 1% that it has been going to the Game and Fish Fund and now directing it to this specific account and then appropriating it out. So it's not directing any additional funds out of that surcharge. It's just primarily appropriating those funds to the DNR, as Chairman Wagenius had said.
Representative Paymar.
Well, Mr. Chair, then the follow-up question, this is for, I assume, conservation officers within the DNR.
Yes.
Would they then not be using post-board training funds in lieu of what you're creating here?
Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, I would have to, okay. I don't know that answer. I believe the answer would be no, because they're specifically appropriated to them a certain amount, but I would have to find that answer out from the DNR.
Representative Paymar.
That's fine for now.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just wanted to thank Representative Wagenius for the Permanent School Trust Fund section in this bill. This is a result of much work by Representative Dietrich, and it goes nicely with a section that will be in the K-12 Education Finance Bill. And I think that it's always been, as far from the standpoint of the Education Committee, about the money, and I think the fact that this study, unlike others that have been more generic and non-specific, this one focuses on the money, and that will give us really good information where we can have an informed discussion next year. So I wanted to thank her.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Representative Greiling, it's great that we're finally looking at certain things about school trust, but you know, this is an issue I've been talking about around here in our caucus and on the House floor for 24 years, and we've had study after study. In fact, Representative Carlson, when he was chair, I believe, of the K-12 Policy or Finance Committee, did a study in the 1990s. And I don't know why we need to study this issue again. The fact of the matter is that in other states, there are independent trusts, managers that manage the school trust lands, because the DNR and in those other states has confusion over what their responsibility is. Now, Representative Wagenius, you got elected with me, and you know one of the first issues we had, big issue, was on school trust land that was leased out to cabin owners, and a former assistant commissioner of the DNR brought a lawsuit, evidently, I don't know why, but had his friend bring a lawsuit when about maybe 2 or 3% of the total trust had to do with leases of land, or the revenues in the endowment had to do with leases of land. Meanwhile, that same division, I believe, was putting zero in the trust fund. Members, we should probably do a study and hear why from 1980 to 1991 the DNR sold $3 to $4 million of stumpage off of school trust land and put zero, not one red cent. You know, this is a way to increase school funding without the taxpayers of this state having to get hit one nickel, not one penny. And frankly, you know, there's a book out recently about the theft of timber on school trust land at the turn of the last century, and how probably the Hinckley fire was set, where a number of lives were lost to hide the theft of stumpage on school trust lands. And there were studies done by the Minnesota Senate in 1880-something about the theft of school trust lumber. And we've got the DNR doing it. And I don't know how often we need to study this. Representative Greiling, what does line 2.30 exactly mean, an accurate description of school trust lands and their land classification? School trust lands, we know where they are, we know they're school trust lands, and we know what their classification is. What does that mean? And I want to ask you this. Is this study going to come out of the school trust forestry suspense account to pay for this study?
Representative Wagenius.
What we are doing, the work, frankly, will be done here. We are getting information
here
in the legislature by Mr. Reinholz, Mr. Groh, and Mr. Marks. So the information will be come from DNR. This is telling DNR this is what we want. But the analysis, let me just give you an example. And if the example is the one I put on the next page. I mean, because I've been trying to think about how the school trust lands should be supported by DNR. And we were having a hearing in my committee about 2 days ago. When people want to spend game and fish money to give to farmers so they can hunt on farmland. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, if we have the capacity or the will to give some of that money to farmers so we can have additional hunting land, why have we not, over the years, taken essentially charged a user fee and put it in the school trust lands, in the game and fish fund, because folks are hunting on those lands. So, but I don't know how much land is being hunted on right now. I really don't. I mean, if I knew the answers to some of these questions, we could probably do it this year, but I don't know the answers to those questions. So how much land is used for hunting? I know in the WMA system, there's about 1.2 million acres. A lot of that is acquired land. But the testimony in my committee 2 days ago was that 100,000 acres of that is probably school trust land. Of that 100,000, some of it is swamp, some of it is peat, and some of it is forest. So what we need to know is how much is forest, because that is available for hunting. So those are WMAs. Those are definitely hunting lands. So it's that kind of information that I don't think anybody has peeled down the onion. I mean, we've talked in theory, but now I want us to talk in dollars and cents and acreage.
Well, Mr. Representative Rocavina, to my question, is the school trust going to pay the DNR to do the research?
No.
What's the school trust charge on page one of the fiscal note for $676,000?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rocavina, that 676 is actually revenue that's Reinhold. From Section 40 of the bill, the forestry part of the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Rocavina.
Mr. Myers is in the audience. You know, we're going to study and study and study, and then we're going to have a study to recommend whether we charge people to hunt on school trust land. I think that would be a minimal
financial
amount of money. Mr. Myers, can you tell the committee how much stumpage was sold last year on school trust land and how much was actually put in the endowment for the school kids?
Myers, you want to come down? Welcome to committee. If you identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I do not have the certification report with me. The issue with timber receipts are we charge a 15% down payment. The rest of the receipts are put into the fund upon cutting when that stumpage is harvested. So I'll get you those numbers. I can get you a copy of the certification report from last year that was approved, signed off by management and budget. The case of last year was we had timber sales that were the cost of the price of timber last year on average was about $19 a cord. The cost of managing those forests throughout the state trust land and state forest land were more than that. So we put in of the receipts we received after our costs were certified for our activities on forest lands, we deposited, I believe, $200,000 into the permanent school trust fund and the university trust fund. But we did a substantial amount of activity labor-wise to improve our forest stands for more stumpage value in the future and to reduce the threat and impact of fire on those lands as well. Harvesting intermediate timber stand treatments, thinning the timber stands so they'll be more productive, grow faster, grow bigger, be more valuable in the future. You need to look at forest management in terms of 40 to 80 years, Representative Rivina. You know that very well. And the cost we put in today do not come out the next year. They come out in 5-10 year biennium from now where we're at. So we took advantage of the activity in the timber market to provide some future value within our forests into the future. I will provide Representative Rukavina and the committee, if they wish, with a copy of that certification report.
Well, Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I do know about working in the woods, and Assistant Commissioner, I would beg to differ with you on what you're improving. How much of your stumpage was popple and birch?
Mr. Myers.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, I don't have that information with me today. We weren't aware that this amendment was coming up today, so I can provide that information to you. And I don't know if Mr. Tomlinson has
Mr.
that
Tomlinson
information with him
here.
Or not.
Let's ask him.
And because, members, I would assume that the DNR does no improvement on popple and birch, that it just suckers out of its cutting, and then they grow up again out of the same root system, and so I'm just curious.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Tomlinson. You introduce
yourself. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name's Bob Tomlinson. I'm the assistant director with the DNR Division of Forestry. About 80%, Representative Rukavina, of all the timber harvested is aspen.
And so, Mr. Thompson, what do you do that you took all that money to improve aspen?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, forest stand improvement, it's not just, you know, there's a lot of the aspen sites that are not necessary, that we are harvesting, that we'd like to convert back to other longer-lived conifer species, for one thing. That's one thing. But half of the sites that we harvest, we do artificial regeneration on, tree planting and seeding to other species. A lot of the aspen, thankfully, does come back naturally and very productive, but a lot of the sites are not necessarily conducive long-term to managing for aspen as well. The other thing that we've been doing a lot more of late is investing in the hardwood stands in central Minnesota, northern hardwoods that run up from Aiken County all the way up into Itasca and beyond, and going in and doing a lot more what we call intermediate thinning in those stands, which takes more work to go in and mark out the stands and have loggers select rather than even age management like might be applied in the aspen stand. So there's a variety of different practices that we're doing relative to the improvement category. Much of that's paid by bonding, which we don't certify costs for, but a lot of the time and effort that goes into the marking of the trees and the bud capping and of pines and things like that to protect them from deer browse and all those sorts of things like that are certifiable costs that we do include. So,
well, Mr. Chair and members, I won't prolong this because I could keep going and going about the abuse of this on this fund. And Representative Carlson, you've been around here, you and Representative Kahn, you know how long this issue and how long we've studied this issue. And the fact of the matter is people are actually starting to catch on around here. And I think that's why we're seeing this amendment is because people are finally starting to catch on about the abuse of this fund. Mr. Tomlinson, one last question. What percentage of your forestry division's dollars come from school trust chargebacks?
Mr. Tomlinson?
Our general operating budget, which is non-fire, non-nursery, is about roughly $30 million, of which about half of that comes from the timber receipts, $15 million approximately, and this is ballpark, and of that about 60% comes from school trust fund lands.
And
I think that's pretty close.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thompson, how much of the fire protection that we levy every year, which is, I think, an open-end account, comes from the school trust?
Representative Mr. Thompson.
I'm not sure how to answer that. I do know that we certify about $2 or $2.5 million worth of cost against the school suspense account. That money is transferred back to the general fund. That does not come to the DNR, back to us. So it comes back to the general fund, and then you reappropriate to us through the fire direct and through the open appropriation for fighting fires.
Tell them how much we've spent on firefighting in this last
year. Well, an average year is $18 million.
That's right.
That's the average, five-year average, I believe that is.
That we spend in general fund.
And Mr. Chair, the question is it the obligation of school children, the state, to pay for firefighting fires on all lands, private lands, public lands, acquired lands? Mr. Thomason, is there a different formula or a different charge or a different way to calculate the charges on school trust lands for fighting fires versus on acquired lands and other state-owned lands?
Mr. Thomason.
Mr. Chair, Representative Recovina, we right now, the way we charge it, we total up all the costs, and then we proportion it out to how much the trust fund lands are in proportion to other ownerships in which we're protecting. And so in that regards with fire, we're looking at the 4 million acres or so of trust fund land that we have in the state in proportion to about 20 or 25 million total that we provide protection on throughout the state.
Do the acquired lands, Mr. Chair or Mr. Thompson, do the acquired lands pay an assessment to fight fires?
Mr.
Or does
Thomas
the general fund pay for those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Recovina, no, they don't. And you bring up a good point. I mean, this
is a very good point. I've been bringing it up for 24 years, members. This is what I'm trying to tell you. This is why this amendment's here. Because somebody has a bill that says, no more fox in charge of the chicken coop. We're going to manage these lands like the Constitution says to raise money for public education at no expense to the taxpayers. And now we're seeing another study and another, you know, and that's why it's here. Because Representative Wagenius, you're a very, very sharp woman. I've been serving with you for 24 years, but you won't know what questions to ask, and I won't either. And I know this issue better than anybody to find out how deep the abuse has been. You won't know. I won't know. No one else will know in this body. And the fact of the matter is that every other state that has much less school trust land than us, a lot of them generate way more money every year because they have an independent trust manager that manages their trust lands. And that's the bottom line here.
Representative Wagenius.
No, Representative Rukavina, I don't know the numbers.
I don't either.
And that's what we're going to have. And will I be able to figure it out? No. But will Mr. Reinholz be able to figure it out? Yes.
No.
I have great confidence. Yes, he will.
No, he won't. He will not. There's been people, and Mr. Reinholz is good too, Mr. Chair and Representative Gaines. He's very, very good. I've known Jim for years and years too. But he's been around this issue, and he hasn't been able to figure it out either. We could have 10 Jim Reinholz, and they'll get run circles run around them by the people that are going to be hiding where this money is going and what it's being used for and the different formulas to charge the school trust.
Representative Wagenius.
One of the problems we're running into, members, is that every school, every state is different. I listened to the testimony from the state of Utah and where they got their money for their school trust lands. 75% of it came from oil and gas leases. Don't we wish? 25% of it came from coal mining. We don't have that either. A teeny part of Utah's money came from forestry. The other portion that was left over that wasn't in the three that I just mentioned was from selling lands. So every state is different, and I don't think we can say Minnesota is going to follow any particular state. I think we have to analyze the numbers in Minnesota. How can we best optimize what we have in Minnesota? And I would agree with you that we haven't done what we need to do. But I don't run DNR, Representative Rukavina. It would be fun, but I don't do that.
No. Sometimes I think the old Soviet Union system does. But one point for the committee, and Representative Wagenius, 80% the last time I was on this issue of our trust, $600-some million of trust money came from mining in this state, which we are lucky to have minerals,
right,
of which many folks sitting at this table will question whether we should mine any of those other minerals, where we have estimates of over $1.5 billion, conservative estimates, $1.5 billion worth of wealth. 14% of that trust has come from forestry sales, and I will venture to say, and I'll place a bet without even knowing the statistics, that we have more forests than Utah. And a wild guess. And thirdly, you're right, about 6% of the money came from all the sales of Section 16 and 36, south of Hinckley, basically, and other sales and trades of land. But that's my point exactly. We've had the DNR going after a school trust for lakeshore leases when they were taking all the money for timber sales. And I just don't know, you get to the bottom of it without doing what Representative Dietrich has done this year, pushing this issue farther than a lot of people have tried over three or so decades to do. And that's why I think the only reason we're seeing this amendment here. And I just guess I'll leave it because I got a lot of other questions about your bill.
Representative Rukavina, would you say the key over above whether there are mineral resources or how much money comes from timber or land sales, the issue really has to do with what agency is in charge of managing these school trust lands and whether or not there should be an independent agency dedicated to the welfare of school children?
That's exactly right. And that's the point. And Mr. Chair, I can hear myself getting ridiculed by Representative Hausman over here that I'm running for statewide office and bringing up these issues. Representative Hausman, I'm going to be honest to the people of the state of Minnesota, whether you like it or not. And the issue here is letting the DNR take money from our school kids, money that, and an increase in money every year. So if you think that's right, that's fine. You can ridicule me all you want, Representative Hausman. You can go to my other issues, too. Because, Representative Hausman, what's in a windmill? What's in a solar panel? What's in an electric car? Everything I have heard you say you want. You think they materialize out of thin air? Or do you think all those minerals that are in those things I just mentioned that I know you support and have supported strongly come from the earth and could be mined right here in Minnesota, ironically, on school trust land? and done right. So you can sit over there, and you and Representative Winkler can snicker and all you want, and that's fine. Snicker as hard as you want. We'll see who's snickering a little while later.
All right.
Representative Winkler, go ahead. Both of you can sit over there and snicker all you want. That's fine with me. But this is an issue I've been honest about for 24 years, and nobody's wanted to address until a metro legislator finally figured out, you know, Rukavina's been right the whole time. And now we see an amendment coming that is kind of acknowledging, well, we better slow this train down because it might actually go somewhere. And the DNR might lose some funding that the school kids have been paying for years. Like I said, Weyerhaeuser, what he stole and what they stole from the school trust is, I think, pales in comparison to what's happened around here.
Well, we have two more who would like to discuss the A-16 amendment, Representative Greiling and Representative Hausman, and then after that, we need to hold a vote, possibly, with one other exception.
I've raised the
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really quick because I think we talked about this enough. But just for members' information, the goals of the K-12 Finance Committee are to have, we're proposing in our bill this year, to have such a person that would look, of course, we look at things in this state on economic development. We look at things on environmental purposes. But we think that for the school children, there should be a person looking from the perspective of not economic development, not the environment, but for the maximizing the revenue for the school children. And we're proposing such a person and to put that person in the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And then our other goal would be to have the management costs of the school trust lands, some of which go to economic development, employing people in forestry, some of which go to maintaining land for environmental purposes or forests. Fire suspension protection accounts or whatever. All those things we do think need to be done and paid for, but not by the permanent school trust land. So if we could go back to the having those things paid for by the general fund, then a lot of people would be looking at how much is coming being charged for those things. But the idea that the school children only make the profit after all of our other goals have been met, environmental, economic development, and maintaining the lands for other purposes, we think is selling the school children short. And so I think this is a wonderful amendment to get that information that that person who we're having start on July 1st of next year to have this information and to start working right away. I think this is not a stalling tactic, but yet a preparing that is needed and fits in with the plan that Representative Dietrich is proposing.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, it was just to follow up on that. In that other bill, however, there is a suggestion that all other public good it doesn't have a valid claim. And I would think that that particular line wouldn't be one that you believe that you can educate and raise money but still do it with the idea that we have also a valid interest in protecting our resources.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman. You know me well. That's deleted in the education finance bill. What we're going to have in there is that this person would have undivided loyalty to the school children. And we don't want to say we're going to mash over everything else, but we want somebody looking out with undivided loyalty for school children. And so you can make of that what you will. Everyone could have various interpretations, but I think it's very clear that we need a person that whose mission is to look out for the school children. That's what we're missing. We have people looking out for the forestry jobs, and people would like to do mining, and people would like hunting for free on the school trust lands, and people would like pristine lands kept for the environment. I would like all those things. We probably all would. But who's watching out for the school children? And so the language that remains in the bill, I think, is crystal clear and needed, and that's undivided loyalty. This person is looking only from the lens of the school children and can use the information. Right now, whoever we have to give us information has all these other lenses, and no one has that lens, and that's what we're after.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to get back to the first issue and get off this for a minute.
that Representative Paymar brought up, I don't know where that first section came from for the peace officer training account, if that came from DNR or not, but Representative Wagenius, I'm very uncomfortable with this type of a thing. Obviously, that account has been utilized already for peace officer training, and it's working fine. Just from a, and again, I'll talk to the Ways and Means Chair, who I know left, he's got his own committee running, but he was uncomfortable too, just on a tracking basis. I mean, Section 357 is overseen by Representative Paymar's division. You don't oversee those monies. They can change. They can be adjusted. He's the one that oversees it, and then he appropriates it in his bill to the peace officer training. I don't know why that one still works, and now we're going to take money out of Paymar's division or whatever your, I don't know the name of your committee. We're going to take it out of there, and then we're going to move it into a game and fish fund, and then so it's appropriate from there to there, then from the game and fish fund, then it'll be appropriate out for training. To me, that's a nightmare. Representative Wagenius, why can't we do it the way we're doing it now? Why do we have to put this into statute?
Representative Wagenius.
Actually, we are doing it the way we're doing it now. I mean, this is the current statute, but there is no appropriation language. So the money has just been sitting there, not appropriated. If you could hold on. Because it was sitting there and not appropriated, it kept growing and growing and growing, and then was taken to fill in the budget gap. All I'm doing is appropriating it to where everybody thought it was going to go in the
Mr. Chair, and I disagree with that, because I think if it is sitting there unappropriate, then it's up to Representative Paymar's committee to understand what
he
to do with
it,
not to yours.
A big deal to me.
I just don't like sending criminal and traffic offender money that I know is dedicated, the 1%, wherever he's talking about, to peace officer training, but why we would now be, I don't think we should, if that's what we're doing, we should even go backwards. We shouldn't be establishing any account in the Game and Fish Fund for it. They should walk over to that committee and say, here's what we need each year for peace officer training. They then can understand if they have the right monies or not. They can adjust the surcharge or not. But, I'm not picking on you. I'm picking on the DNR or the whole system that's in place to say, why would we even do that? This is making it very complicated. When I think it should be a line item appropriation that the Public Safety Finance Committee does.
Representative Wagenius.
Let me ask Representative Paymar, would that be something you would like to do, to take control of the peace officer training in DNR? It's
he
fine
does
with
everything
me.
Else.
I mean, there's been a lot of muck in DNR peace officer training. It does need oversight, and if Representative Paymar would like to do it, more power to him.
Representative Paymar.
Ms. Chair, Representative Wagenius, this is the first that I just saw your amendment here, and I that's why I was a little surprised, because I would have thought this change would have come before our committee in the first place, and it didn't. And so, that is the responsibility of the Public Safety Finance Committee, is to deal with peace officer training, and I understand that a portion of this was carved out for the DNR, and
that's what happened.
And
if folks do not like that it was carved, this was not part of my doing. If it was carved out to the DNR at some point in the past, and all I'm doing is making sure the money is spent. If we want to revisit that issue, that is also fine with me. I mean, I actually think there's reform that needs to be done across peace officer training. So this is not, but what the dilemma we were in is the money was just sitting there unspent. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius,
Representative Paymar.
I wished I would have known it was unspent. But now that I know that it's there, maybe we should really. I think it's fine to have this language in statute, but I do think it should come under the oversight of the Public Safety Finance Committee, because it's all related to the $75 surcharge on criminal and traffic offenders, and that seems to be where, if there needs to be an appropriation, it seems to me it should come out of that division. But I'm happy to talk with you about it as we go further with the bill and see if there's...
Representative Wagenius.
If you want to delete this section, it is just fine with me, as long as Representative Paymore will take it over. I don't want it just sitting as a...
He knows there's money, he'll take it over.
It is money in the Game and Fish Fund right now, and we are just saying the money in the Game and Fish Fund, because the peace officers do the game and fish work. We are, all this is saying is that money sitting in the Game and Fish Fund now moves into peace officer training so that they can do the game and fish work.
Mr. Chair, that
President Paymore.
Under the circumstances, and I'd like to work with Mr. Reynolds and Mr. Carter on this as we go forward, I'd like to make the motion, if it's, as long as the author's okay, to delete Section 43 of the amendment.
And I think it's on 2.1, too. There's some language, isn't there? Yeah. Representative Wagenius?
Well,
Representative Paymore.
You don't want to delete the whole section because there's other language in there that you don't want to delete. Let me tell you, if you want to delete line 1.4 to 1.13, and then skip down and delete 1.21 to 220. Mm-hmm. I don't want you to delete the other language. That's right. Other areas.
Chair, I'd make
you
that motion.
Your motion?
I'd make that motion.
All right. Representative Paymire moves that section starting with 1.4 down to 1.13 and 1.21 to 2.20 be deleted. Any discussion? Representative Kahn.
With that deletion, what kind of place are we going to have to discuss this in the course of this legislative session?
Representative Paymire.
Well, it stays the same, so it's still not being appropriated.
That's right.
Representative Paymar's bill has, I don't know if that's, I don't know if you're going to have a policy bill and it's appropriate for that. I would actually suggest that you leave this in here and then proceed to work on it from this point on instead of trying to insert it back at some point. It's always plenty of places where we can take things out, and it sounds like Representative Wagenius is perfectly happy to work with you on it, and I know, and I think looking at it more carefully, you can see where it wants to go. But I think I kind of, knowing nothing about this at all, I kind of agree that just leaving a pot of money that's being collected and not appropriated is not a good idea.
Representative Paymore.
Well, Mr. Chair, our bill is already passed out.
I know.
So you're right on that account. So.
This bill,
I make a suggestion?
I don't know if you're having a policy bill or whatever, but my suggestion would be to leave this language in here. It seems as if there's, you know, no button.
You know. Mr. Chairman.
It seems to me that we could work on it, but that taking it out is not a good idea because then there's nothing to work on.
Representative Wagenius.
Let me suggest that. I mean, I think what we're trying to get to is oversight by your committee, and I think that's a good idea. So what if we leave the language in but come up with additional language that says that you are going to oversee what's being done with the money by DNR for training or some such language? I mean, because I'm glad to do that. I think that is appropriate.
Mr. Chair, that would be fine. I think that's a good resolution. I'll withdraw the amendment.
The amendment has been withdrawn. Any further discussion on the A16 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
Motion carries. All right. Now we have the A7 amendment. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A7 amendment was brought to me by Representative Bigham, and it relates to a hazardous waste incineration facility in her city of Cottage Grove, and it just delays a little bit to make sure that we have all the issues worked out and gives us a little time in case we need any policy changes at the state level to deal with this. The permitting of that facility to accept waste outside of the group that owns the facility, it delays that permit until March 1st, 2011.
Any further discussion on the A7 amendment? Seeing none, then Representative Knuth's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And Representative Knuth, you have the A15 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A15 amendment, I would like to move the A15 amendment, and it relates to Section 5 a little bit. It's related to similar issues. Representative Saylor has been working on this. We increased the fees paid to the DNR for applications to put utilities across DNR lands significantly, like $500 up to $4,500, and the $1,500 was also raised, and so this is trying to make those fees more reasonable so the entities trying to get these crossings can afford those fees. One is raised slightly, but one is decreased very significantly if you look at the amendment. And then language to make Representative Wagenius comfortable with the amendment so that if the fees don't quite work out, it's not going to affect the DNR budget in any way. It'll just... they'll have to reduce department costs and activities to make up for it. And I know Representative Saylor has been working with the DNR quite a bit on this, and this is kind of where they're finding agreement.
Any discussion on the A15 amendment? Representative Wagenius.
I understand that Representative Saylor talked to Marty Vadas, who is in charge of lands, and he believes this works.
Any further discussion on the A15 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Amendment adopted. Representative Junkie, the A6 amendment.
I'd offer the A6, and members, I think Representative Wagenius is amenable to this. This is an issue that came through and has passed environment policy and is in, I believe, the Game and Fish Bill now. It's a big issue as far as invasive species transportation of them and preventing their transportation, and it just simply is putting into statute that boat owners are required to remove their drain plugs when they go from body of water to body of water, thus in our area preventing the transport, hopefully, of zebra mussels, which are starting to cruise around the state. So it's a common sense thing, we understand, but this was probably the number one issue that came out of the DNR meetings around the state, including in my area, where there were packed houses of both anglers and lakeshore owners. So I'd like to put it on this bill, too, just so we can keep it alive and well on a number of vehicles.
Any further discussion on the A6 amendment? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chuck, I just want to make sure I understand the language because I think the wording confuses me and what the intent is. In line 1.7, 1.8, it says other boating-related equipment holding water excluding marine sanitary systems. And then you have down at 111 and 112, marine sanitary systems are excluded from this requirement. Is that a double exclusion of the same thing, or?
Representative Junkie.
I didn't draft the language. This is actually, as Knuth said, we're kind of doing Bigham's legislative agenda. This is a Bigham bill,
well, that
too.
That explains a lot.
So I'm offering it on her behalf. So if you talk to her, I'm sure she'd be happy to visit with you.
I'll just mark this up for her.
Representative Wagenius.
Representative Junkie is absolutely right when the biggest concern that citizens have is over invasive species. I would totally agree with this. This bill never did get to my committee, but I do think anything we can do with regard to invasive species is a plus.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Representative Junkie, again, in my principle of trying not to pass bills with words, I don't know. Could you tell us what an aquatic macrophyte is?
I would refer you to Representative Bingham also. And I'd ask her on the floor.
Any further discussion, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And certainly we do support these are good things to do that help keep our lakes and waters free of those invasive species. But the exclusion of marine sanitary systems, does anybody... I just get concerned about, adding an exclusion here. There must be a reason, but why would you exclude marine sanitary systems?
Representative Wagenius.
I think we don't want to put some waters like our toilet water back in a lake.
Right. If you have a large boat with an outhouse, you don't want to drain that, maybe. Okay.
I was thinking of, you know, draining water from boats and lake water. I just wasn't thinking that. Okay.
Some larger larger craft do
We're
have
good to go.
Disposal systems.
Oh, sorry.
Any further discussion on the A6th Amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Okay, now we're on the main motion. Any further discussion? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McGinnis, had I known your bill was going to take this long, I would have found your Patrick McCormick, who drafted an amendment for me for the Game and Fish Bill, because I'm nervous that the Game and Fish Bill will make it through to the floor. So I'm just for the record, I'm telling you that your folks did an amendment for me that the story is my son-in-law, who's in the Guard, went to Afghanistan, came back from Afghanistan, was given a deer hunting license to hunt for free on leave. Then this last 2 months ago, he had to take training from the DNR to qualify to get a deer hunting license this fall, because he was born after the 1977, or that date that you have to have safety training. He's also passed rifle training in boot camp, but he's also passed the elite sniper training. And for him to pay $25 and go to a class is just ridiculous for these veterans to do this. And I know that might be a fiscal note, but I want to bring this to the, I want to get it in a bill so we don't have to make our veterans do that. It's silly. So just, and I'm good that Representative Paymar is here, because I'm not doing a gun thing. I'm just doing what's sensible, I think.
Representative Rukavina.
As soon as you said sniper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the horse trail pass is now the horse pass, and from what I read this, to go on any lands administered by the commissioner if you're riding a horse. And I don't know what driving a horse is. Does driving a horse mean if you're trailering the horse?
No.
Buggy.
Oh, okay. But in any event, basically that's all the land in my in a lot of my townships is state land. And I have a lot of friends who ride their horses, and there's no trails. They just ride through the woods, and oftentimes they got to clean up, you know, brush or windfalls and that. And now they're going to have to pay to do that?
Representative Wagenius?
You have asked a question beyond my expertise. This is Representative Eakin's bill. I'm going to ask DNR to come down and help us with this.
Identify yourself again.
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This is a provision that was brought forward by the Horse Council. The problem that we've seen that we're trying to rectify is that the current horse pass, some people are getting around it by riding off of the trail. The horse pass that's in statute right now is required for horse trails to ride on the trails. People are, we're experiencing something that we'd experienced previously on some of our other trail systems. People are riding off of trail and causing new trails to be established within the forest that we don't want to have be there. They aren't part of the trail system. So what we're trying to do is clarify where the uses of this pass has to be, and it is supported by the Horse Council.
Well, Representative Rokovina.
I'll tell you, when my neighbor Frank Mackey, and he's a big Finn guy, that's a hold of this. He's been riding out there, and he comes through my property, and then he goes into state property, and the way I look at this, he's got to buy a horse pass, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't even know he's out there, so I suppose. you know, the game warden, but now the game warden will know there's a new law, and then he'll be out there and he'll be arresting me, and the next thing you know, I'll be. Well, I hate to tell you what that big fin will do to me, but anyway. Am I reading this right, Mr. Myers?
Mr. Chair, members, this does change it from state trails and state parks, rec areas, and forests Just all lands administered by the commissioner. So that would be possible impact, yes.
So if my friends, and we got the, you know, Spirit, we got the Burnside State Forest, we got all kinds of state forests around there, and there's old forestry roads and everything that are very good. They'll hold up 11 cords of wood in a semi, and if they ride down those trails on their horses and they don't have a pass, they are going to get some kind of a fine. Am I not mistaken?
Myers?
Coming to get the pass.
Wagenius.
I think
can we fix this up?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm glad to fix it up. It seems to me,
except on trust lands, we'll have them pay for that.
There'll be a new pass.
Yeah.
What is
that?
But I'm reading this to be everywhere they're driving horse.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I will work with you and the author to fix this between here and the floor if you desire, or.
I think I could actually just do it here and let's get it at least partially fixed. And here's the way I would suggest it, Representative Rukavina. On line 1731, keep the old language. And on line 1732, keep the old language, but don't have in state forest. And then get rid of the new language.
There's a lot of trails in state forest.
Oh, well. Then it would just revert. Let's just revert to the old language and not say on lands administered by the commissioner and revert to the old language. So I would delete the language. I'll make that motion just to make people easier on line 1731 to 33.
All right. So Representative Wagenius moves then to restore the. Deleted language and then to remove the underlined language on lands administered by the commissioner. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. No. Any discussion?
There's an increase in the pass.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion carries.
If there's additional work that would be needed to be done, I'd be happy to work on that, but I think we took a big bite out of that.
And then Mr. Chair,
Rukavina.
Mr. Myers is up there. Mr. Myers, why did we have Section 55 in here on removing sunken logs? Because I think we had an issue about this before, and if I'm not mistaken, I saw where I think a gentleman up in Duluth is removing old logs that were from the turn of the last century that sunk to the bottom of lakes, and they make excellent logs for Stradivariuses and other stringed instruments. They're the type of really.
Stradivarius is dead.
Well, I know Stradivarius is. The company still makes violins. They still make violins, and they make them out of very old lumber.
Right.
And they said that this gentleman was selling them to people that make guitars and violins and cellos and everything else because they're excellent for it. So, why are we removing the ability to do this?
Mr.
Myers.
Chair, Representative Rukavina, I wish Representative Howells was still here. This currently is against the law. There is session law that prohibits the removal of sunken logs. The issue was it was permitted. Then there were studies done about the mercury, the contamination that was being dredged up in the sediment in some lakes in Lake Plantagenet. I can't even say the name of the lake. I always get confused with that. Up in Representative House districts, the legislature allowed it. Then the next year they repealed it. It's in session law. We're clarifying that and just putting this language in statute in 103G where it should belong. So the language is currently the position of the laws of the state of Minnesota prohibit the removal of sunken logs. Actually, it prohibits the commissioner to authorize a permit for that activity. So the Lake Superior issue may be a little bit different because it's a border water, things of that nature. But currently, right now, an individual cannot go into a lake and harvest sunken logs. You will still be able to we had discussion in committee about removing floating logs that are a hazard to navigation and things like that. That is still allowed. But what we're clarifying here is that the harvesting, we may not issue leases to remove sunken logs or issue permits for the removal of sunken logs. So that's the issue we're trying to just clarify.
Representative Rukavina, is that
I'm saddened that Stradivarius and all the other beautiful stringed instruments made by, you know, those long dead.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A very instructive discussion. A question I have is on Section 48 and Section 50 having to do with groundwater monitoring. The title of Section 48 was Monitoring to Evaluate Impacts from Appropriations. I wasn't quite sure what that meant there. I have a concern. I come from a district in a county that has very sandy soil. And so groundwater, and they are produce farming for the large part. So it's potatoes and produce and real basic things like that that are used locally and are used within the state very heavily. So can you explain a little bit about the purpose? And then there's also another bill, Representative Wagenius, that you have that also has to do with groundwater. So I'm concerned about the fact that I have these two sections here, and then we have that bill. And in particular, on line 28.25, that the monitoring costs that supply more than one appropriator can be distributed by the commissioner and assessed. And so there's actually money tied into here that are just passed along. So it's just a combination of things, and the other bill also had fees with it. So if you could maybe just give a little more information on that.
Representative Wagenius.
This is the department bill. This is Representative Eakin's bill, and I believe Mr. Lacasmo is here and can tell you about it. They're just updating their language. This is not Mr. Lacasmo.
Welcome to committee. If you identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Lacasmo, Director of Division of Waters for DNR. But the policy bill did two things, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kiffmeyer. There was a section, it repeals a section of law that dealt with A and B areas for determining the parameters for issuing permits. And that was an area A had sufficient information and you didn't need as much detail, area B didn't. That was an old section of law. It really never materialized to get all of the information to have to distinguish between those areas in the state. So this section of law dealing with the requirements looking at appropriation permits is there's one section that deals with those requirements for surface water, and this is a parallel section dealing with groundwater that replaces the section that's repealed. On dealing with the your other question about dealing with the monitoring requirements and the ability to apportion those costs. We need to monitor the impacts, especially in the sandy areas. There's probably more direct impacts from a monitoring or from a production well than in other areas. You'd see impacts in a wider distance. So in an effort, the permittees have a responsibility to do some monitoring. And what this language does is allows us in a specific area to look at all of those permits and determine how to apportion those costs instead of having each individual drill a well. The example that kind of forced this issue was one in Mankato, where there were five of the six entities that agreed to share in the costs and drill a new monitoring well, and the sixth didn't want to. And if they hadn't, we could amend their permit and require them to drill an individual well. So we're looking at this to be able to spread those costs uniformly among all the users. It's not just the last one in that has this requirement to do the monitoring. And it's in the effort to have the right information to make decisions and to manage those groundwater resources.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I am, you did away with the A and B classifications, and then I hear about groundwater, and then there was another type of water.
Mr. Chairman, surface water, if you're taking from the lake or a river.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, when you talk about this groundwater monitoring and use the word parallel, and I see all of this as new language. So is this same language there for surface water, and then now you're copying that language and using it for groundwater? just want to be, I'm not sure if I understood all that you said.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, it's not exactly parallel because there's two different resources, but there are requirements that need to be met for us to process a surface water permit, and these now are requirements for evaluating groundwater permits. And they are similar to what used to exist for the A and B type areas in the state.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then what you're basically saying is this is the same, just a different structure, A, B, now you've divided into surface and ground, but basically that these same people that were dealing with this groundwater and some of these kinds of things, that has not changed?
Mr. Locus-Small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's very little change. I mean, it's not exactly because you're putting it in a new format, but it is essentially the same requirements that existed previously.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One follow-up to that. Does this increase the costs to the users, or does this spread it out? How does this deal with the cost? And I thought I heard you kind of say it may spread it out amongst them and may possibly decrease some of the costs amongst all the users.
Mr. Locus-Small.
Chairman, this for the ability to... For the groundwater monitoring piece, this would reduce an individual's cost from what it could be if they had to do it. If they had to do an observation well themselves, it would be much more expensive than having the department look at a process to apportion those costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That addresses my questions.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Wagenius, if I can go back to the horse trail pass issue on page 18, lines 18.3 to 18.5. Just clarify for me, it says if their horse owner is riding on their own private property, they don't need a trail pass. Does this, in essence, say that anyone riding a horse other than on their own property will be required to have a trail pass then?
Representative Wagenius.
I don't think that's the case, but I am going to make sure that I'm absolutely accurate on that by asking Mr. Meyer. Because of the way we just repeal the language, I don't think so.
Mr. Myers.
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. No, the language you're referring to, Representative Szymanski, is similar to language that we have for snowmobile trail passes, for example, that would prohibit or exempt a person if there's a segment of a snowmobile trail going through their property from having to have a snowmobile pass on that trail segment. So with this language that we're talking about, if there's a horse trail, a DNR horse trail that goes across your property, you do not need to have a horse pass to ride on that segment that's on your property. The language that we have now will require that pass to be used on the trail system that's out there. We have a designated trail system that's signed, marked, taken care of, maintained. The closest example is the Gateway Trail. It has a dual track. There's a horse track. There's a horse trail and a paved trail there. Those are the types of trails that we need. The user groups came forward and actually had this pass implemented, and they want those revenues to be maintained. So the intent of our language was to capture the people who were abusing the system, riding parallel to the trail system, saying that they didn't need a trail pass. So we're working, and we will be working with the author to clarify that that's the intent of this section.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Meyer, I was just concerned that the way I was reading the language, that virtually every horse housed in Minnesota was going to need a trail pass, and that was my concern.
I think we can state flatly on the record that
it is now 1 minute to 12, and unless there's further discussion, and I see none, Representative Wagenius renews her motion that House File 3702, the first committee engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. The environment is always more exciting than people think.
That was just adjourned. Committee is adjourned.